Patriot Games, adapted from the novel by Tom Clancy. Read for you by Martin Sheen.
When bad men combine, the good must associate, else they will fall one by one, an unpitied sacrifice in a contemptible struggle. Edmund Burke. Ryan was nearly killed twice in half an hour. He left the taxi a few blocks short of his destination. It was a fine, clear day, the sun already low in the blue sky. Ryan had been sitting for hours in a series of straight-back wooden chairs, and he wanted to walk a bit to work the kinks out. Traffic was relatively light on the streets and sidewalks. That surprised him, but he looked forward to the evening rush hour. Clearly, these streets had not been laid out with automobiles in mind, and he was sure that the afternoon chaos would be something to behold. Jack's first impression of London was that it would be a fine town to walk in, and he moved at his usual brisk pace, unchanged since his stint in the Marine Corps, marking time unconsciously by tapping the edge of his clipboard against his leg. Just short of the corner, the traffic disappeared, and he moved across the street early. He automatically looked left, right, then left again, as he had since childhood, and stepped off the curb, and was nearly crushed by a two-story red bus that screeched past him with a bare 2 feet to spare. "Excuse me, sir." Ryan turned to see a police officer. "They call them constables over here," he reminded himself, in uniform, complete to the Mack Sennett hat. "Please do be careful and cross at the corners. You might also mind the painted signs on the pavement to look left or right. We try not to lose too many tourists to the traffic." "How do you know I'm a tourist?" He would know from Ryan's accent. The cop smiled patiently. "Because you look the wrong way, sir, and you're dressed like an American. Be careful then, sir. Good day." The bobby moved off with a friendly nod, leaving Ryan to wonder what there was about his brand-new three-piece suit that marked him as an American. Chastened, he walked to the corner. Painted lettering on the blacktop reminded him to look right, along with an arrow for the dyslexic. He waited for the light to change and was careful to stay within the painted lines. Jack remembered that he'd have to pay close attention to the traffic, especially when he rented the car Friday. Once he was safely across the street, he allowed his gaze to return to the study of the city and its inhabitants. Despite his problems with the traffic, Ryan was a practiced observer. He was walking in a business and professional district. The other people on the street were better dressed than their American counterparts would be, aside from the punkers and their spiked orange and purple hair, he thought. The architecture here was a hodgepodge ranging from Octavian Augustus to Mies van der Rohe, but most of the buildings had an old, comfortable look that in Washington or Baltimore would long since have been replaced with an unbroken row of new and soulless glass boxes. Both aspects of the town dovetailed nicely with the good manners he'd encountered so far. It was a working vacation for Ryan, but first impressions told him it would be a pleasant one nonetheless. There were a few jarring notes. Many people seemed to be carrying umbrellas. Ryan had been careful to check the day's weather forecast before setting out to the Admiralty Building to begin his research. A fair day had been accurately predicted. Why the umbrellas, then? Didn't people trust the local weather service? Maybe that was how the cop knew he was an American. Another thing he ought to have predicted was the plethora of Rolls Royces on the street. He hadn't seen more than a handful of them in his life, and while the streets weren't exactly crowded with them, there were more than a few. He himself usually drove around in a 5-year-old VW Rabbit. He stopped at a newsstand to purchase a copy of The Economist and began paging through it instead of watching where he was going as he went down the street. He presently found himself halfway down the wrong block. Ryan stopped dead and thought back to the city map he'd inspected before leaving the hotel. One thing Jack could not do was remember street names, but he had a photographic memory from maps. He walked to the end of the block, turned left, proceeded 2 blocks, then right, and sure enough, there was St. James Park. Ryan checked his watch. He was 15 minutes early. It was downhill past a monument to a Duke of York, and he crossed the street near a longish classical building of white marble. There were not many people around. So much the better, he thought. He'd deliberately come over after the tourist season. Ryan did not like crowds. The Marine Corps had taught him that.
"Daddy!"
Ryan's head snapped around to see his little daughter running towards him from behind the tree, heedless as usual of her safety. Sally arrived with her customary thump against her tall father. Also as usual, Kathy Ryan trailed behind, never quite able to keep up with their little white tornado. Jack's wife did look like a tourist. Her Canon 35mm camera was draped over one shoulder, along with a camera case that doubled as an oversized purse when they were on vacation. How'd it go, Jack? Ryan kissed his wife. Maybe the Brits don't do that in public either, he thought. Great, babe. They treated me like I own the place. Got all my notes tucked away. He tapped his clipboard. Did you get anything? She smiled in a way that told him she had parted with a fairish bit of the money they had allocated for shopping. The shops here deliver, and we got something really nice for Sally. Oh? Jack bent over to look his daughter in the eye. And what might that be? It's a surprise, Daddy. Daddy, they got a lake with swans and pelicans. Pelicans, Sally. Sally loved pelicans. Big white ones. Uh-huh. Ryan looked up to his wife. Get any good pictures? Oh, sure. London is already canonized. Or would you prefer we spent the whole day shopping? Photography was Kathy Ryan's only hobby, and she was good at it. Ryan looked down the street. The pavement was reddish, not black, and the road was lined with what looked like beech trees. The mall, wasn't it? He couldn't remember, and wouldn't ask his wife, who'd been in London many times. Buckingham Palace was larger than he'd expected, but it seemed a dour building, 300 yards away, hidden behind a marble monument of some sort. Traffic was a little thicker here, but moved briskly. Jack looked back to his wife. What do we do for dinner? Catch a cab back to the hotel, or we can walk. They're supposed to have a good dining room. She looked at her watch. Still early, though. These civilized places make you wait until 8 or 9. He saw another Rolls go by in the direction of the palace. He was looking forward to dinner, though not really to having Sally there. 4-year-olds and 4-star restaurants don't go well together, he reflected. He wondered if the hotel had a babysitting service. Grenade, something in his mind reported. He sensed the whispering sound of fragments in the air, and a moment later heard the clatter of automatic weapons fire. He spun around to see the Rolls turn crooked in the street. The front end seemed lower than it should be, and its path was blocked by a black sedan. There was a man standing at the front fender, firing an AK-47 into the front end, and another man was racing around to the car's left rear. Get down! Ryan grabbed his daughter's shoulder and forced her to the ground behind a tree, yanking his wife roughly down beside her. A dozen cars were stopped raggedly behind the Rolls, none closer than 50 feet, and these shielded his family from the line of fire. Traffic on the far side was blocked by the sedan. The man with the Kalashnikov was spraying the Rolls for all he was worth. Son of a bitch! Ryan kept his head up, scarcely able to believe what he saw. It's the goddamn IRA. They're killing somebody right here. He moved slightly to his left. His peripheral vision took in faces of people up and down the street, turning and staring. This is really happening, he thought, right in front of me, just like that. Just like some Chicago gangster movie. Two bastards are committing murder, just like that. Son of a bitch. Ryan moved further left, screened by a stopped car. He could see one man standing at the left rear of the Rolls, just standing there, his pistol hand extended as though expecting someone to bolt from the passenger door. The bulk of the Rolls screened Ryan from the AK gunner, who was crouched down to control his weapon. The near gunman had his back to Ryan. He was no more than 50 feet away. Ryan would never remember making any conscious decision. He moved swiftly around the stopped car, head down, keeping low and accelerating rapidly, his eyes locked on his target, the small of the man's back, just as he'd been taught in high school football. It took only a few seconds to cover the distance, with Ryan's mind racing out, willing the man to stay still just a moment longer. At 5 feet, Ryan lowered his shoulder and dove off both legs. His coach would have been proud. The blindside tackle caught the gunman perfectly. His back bent like a bow, and Ryan heard bones snap as his victim pitched forward and down. A satisfying clunk told him the man's head had bounced off the bumper on the way to the pavement. Ryan got up instantly, winded but full of adrenaline. The man's pistol had dropped from his hand and lay beside the body. Ryan grabbed it. It looked like a 9mm Makarov, or some East German block military issue. The hammer was back and the safety off. He fitted the man's gun carefully into his right hand. His left hand didn't seem to be working right, but he ignored that. Ryan looked down at the man he'd just tackled and shot him twice in the hip. Then he brought the gun up to eye level and moved to the right rear corner of the Rolls. He crouched lower still and peeked around the edge of the bodywork. The other gunman's AK was lying on the street, and he was firing into the car with his pistol, something else in his other hand. Ryan took a deep breath and stepped from behind the rolls, leveling his automatic at the man's chest. The other gunman turned his head first, then swiveled off balance to bring his own gun around. Both men fired at the same instant. Ryan felt a fiery thump in his left shoulder and saw his own round take the man in the chest. The 9mm slug knocked the man backwards as though from a hard punch. Ryan brought his own pistol back from recoil and squeezed off another round. The second bullet caught the man under the chin and exploded out of the back of his head in a wet pink cloud. Like a puppet with severed strings, the gunman fell to the pavement without a twitch. Ryan kept his pistol centered on the man's chest. Oh, God! The surge of adrenaline left him as quickly as it had come. Time slowed back to normal, and Ryan found himself dizzy and breathless. His mouth was open and gasping for air. Whatever force had been holding him erect seemed to disappear, leaving his frame weak on the verge of collapse. The black sedan backed up a few yards and accelerated past him, racing down the street. Ryan didn't think to take the number. He was stunned by the flashing sequence of events. The man he'd shot twice was clearly dead. Ryan was chilled to see a grenade in his gloved left hand. He turned unsteadily towards the rolls. The first grenade had torn the front end to shreds, and the tires were flat on the blacktop. The windshield had been blasted to fragments. The driver was dead, his face gone, a red, spongy mass. Another body was slumped over in the front seat. There was a red smear on the glass partition separating the driver's seat from the passenger compartment. Jack moved around the car and looked in the back. He saw a young man lying prone on the floor, and under him, the corner of a woman's dress. He tapped the pistol butt against the glass. The man stirred for a moment, then froze. At least he was alive. Ryan looked at his pistol. It was empty, the slide locked back on a dry clip. His breath was coming in shutters now. His legs were wobbling under him, and his hands were beginning to shake convulsively. Brief, sharp waves of intense pain rippled in his wounded shoulder. A soldier was running towards him with a police officer a few yards behind. One of the palace guards, Jack thought. The man had lost his bearskin shako, but still had an automatic rifle with a half foot of steel bayonet perched on the muzzle. Ryan quickly wondered if the rifle might be loaded. This is a guardsman, he told himself, a professional soldier from a crack regiment, maybe as good as a sea marine. How did he get here so fast? Slowly and carefully, Ryan held the pistol at arm's length. He thumbed the clip release button, and the magazine clattered to the street. Next, he twisted the gun so that the soldier could see it was empty. Then he set it down on the pavement and stepped away from it. He tried to raise both hands, but the left one wouldn't move. The guardsman all the time ran smart, head up, eyes tracing left and right, but never leaving Ryan entirely. He stopped 10 feet away with his rifle at low guard, its bayonet pointed right at Jack's throat, just like it said in the manual.
At ease, trooper. I'm one of the good guys.
The guardsman's face didn't change a whit. The boy was a pro, all right. He could hear sirens somewhere and men running in from the other direction. He turned to look, but there was the pain again. The last thing he heard before passing out was his wife's voice.
Soldier, I'm a doctor, and I'm going to treat that wound, so you can put that gun down right now.
So we're awake. How are we feeling? The doctor was in his 50s, tall and spare, and dressed in surgical greens. There was a stethoscope hanging around his neck, and he seemed to be carrying something that Ryan couldn't quite see. He seemed rather tired, but wore a satisfied smile. Ryan tried to speak, but his mouth seemed glued shut. The doctor smiled and nodded to a nurse, then continued to speak. The nurse came forward to give Ryan a sip of water through a glass straw.
You are in the recovery unit of St. Thomas Hospital. You are recovering from surgery on your upper left arm and shoulder. My name is Charles Scott, and I'm your surgeon. My team and I have been working on you for, about 6 hours now, and it would appear that you will probably live.
Rather slowly and sluggishly, Ryan thought to himself that the English sense of humor was a little too dry for this type of situation. He had seen Kathy earlier, he remembered, when he woke up just before the operation. She had whispered something reassuring about the doctor. Sir Charles Scott was not just a surgeon. He was one of the best orthopods in the world. Jack listened patiently.
Your collarbone was broken. We reckon that happened first, before you were shot. Routine fracture. Then a bullet entered the front of your shoulder, just missing the brachial plexus, so we expect no severe nerve damage, smashing into the top of your humerus before lodging just under the skin. Bloody powerful thing, that 9mm. You were quite lucky, Dr. Ryan. Ryan blinked. He was doc to the midshipmen around Annapolis, but where the medical establishment was involved, Dr. Ryan usually meant Kathy. Doctor, you mean my wife, don't you? Sir Charles smiled again. Your wife is a charming and accomplished woman, Doctor, but I could never mistake you for her. You are a professor of history at your Naval Academy, I believe she told me. Fascinating. Now you really must get some rest. There are some people who want to talk with you very badly, and I can't keep them away forever. Ryan awoke at 6:35 a.m. He knew that because it was announced by a disc jockey whose voice faded to an American country and western song of the type Ryan avoided at home by listening to all news radio stations. Yesterday, he thought, I saw something straight out of a news bulletin. The radio was somewhere off to his right, beyond his shoulder. Shoulder. That's why I'm here. He turned his head slowly to the left. He saw his arm first of all. It was sticking up in a plaster and fiberglass cast that went all the way to his hand. His fingers stuck out like an afterthought. He tried to wiggle them. It took several seconds before they responded, but when they did, he let out a long breath and closed his eyes to thank God for that. His mouth tasted like a urinal, and the rest of his body was stiff and sore. He turned his head the other way.
Somebody over there?
A face appeared out of the darkness beyond the bed. Hello, Dr. Ryan. A man stepped forward into the pool of light. He was young, middle 20s or so, and lean. He was dressed casually, his tie loose in his collar, and the edge of a shoulder holster showed under his jacket. Anthony Wilson, sir. I'm supposed to look after you. How are you feeling, sir? Ryan attempted a smile.
About how I look, probably. Is there a glass of water in this place?
I'll ring the sister. Here. Wilson squeezed the button that was pinned to the edge of Ryan's pillow. Less than 15 seconds later, a nurse came through the door and flipped on the overhead lights.
Ah, would awake. How are we feeling?
The sister, her tag said Kittywake, was young and pretty, with the eager, protective look common to nurses. Ryan had seen it before and hated it. She stuck a thermometer in his mouth before he could answer and grabbed his wrist to take his pulse. The thermometer was one of the new electronic sort, and both tasks were completed in moments. Little Miss Efficiency, Ryan told himself. This girl is going to be a real pain in the ass.
Is there anything I might get you, Dr. Ryan?
Her brown eyes belied the wheat-colored hair. She was cute. She had that dewy look. Ryan was unable to remain angry with pretty women and hated them for it, especially nurses that had that dewy look.
Coffee?
Kittywick made a minor adjustment in the covers, beaming at Ryan.
Breakfast is not for another hour. Can I fetch you a cup of tea?
Fine. It wasn't, but it would get rid of her for a little while. Nurse Kittywick breezed out the door with her ingenuous smile.
Hospitals.
Ryan grunted and leaned back into the pillow. It was useless to fight it, he knew. He'd been through this twice before, both times with young, pretty nurses. Being grumpy only made them all the more eager to be overpoweringly nice. They had time on their side. Time and patience enough to wear anyone down. He sighed out his surrender.
So, Wilson, you're a cop, right? Special branch?
No, sir. I'm with C-13, anti-terrorist branch.
Can you fill me in on what happened yesterday? I kind of missed a few things.
Wilson slid his chair closer. Ryan noted he remained halfway facing the door and kept his right hand free.
How much do you remember, Doctor?
I saw, well, I heard an explosion, a hand grenade, I think, and when I turned, I saw two guys shooting hell out of a Rolls-Royce. IRA, I guess. I took two of them out, and another one got away in a car.
Wilson smiled coldly. Not IRA. ULA, Ulster Liberation Army, a Maoist offshoot of the Purvos, nasty buggers. The one you killed was John Michael McClory, very bad boy from Londonderry, one of the chaps who escaped from the maze last July. This is the first time he's surfaced since. We haven't identified the other chap yet. That is, not as of when I came on duty 3 hours ago. The ULA? Ryan shrugged.
The guy I killed, he had an AK. But when I came around the car, he was using a pistol. How come?
The fool jammed it. He had two magazines taped end to end, like you see all the time in the movies, but like they trained us specifically not to do in the powers. We reckon he bashed it. probably, when he came out of the car. Damn good luck for us. You knew you were going after a chap with a Kalashnikov. Wilson examined Ryan's face carefully. Jack nodded.
Doesn't sound real smart, does it?
You bloody fool. Wilson said this just as Kittywake came through the door with a tea tray. The nurse flashed the cop an emphatically disapproving look as she set the tray on the bedstand and wheeled it over. Kittywake arranged everything just so and poured Ryan a cup with delicacy. Wilson had to do his own.
So who was in the car anyway?
Ryan noted strong reactions to his question. You didn't know? Kittywake was dumbfounded. There wasn't much time to find out. Ryan dropped two packets of brown sugar into his cup. His stirring stopped abruptly when Wilson answered his question. The Prince and Princess of Wales and their new baby. The tabloid Mirror's front page was almost entirely a color photograph of himself, sitting unconscious against the rolls. His chest was a scarlet mass. Attempt on His Royal Highness, Marine to the Rescue. The Times headline had been marginally less lurid. Ryan turned the page to see another photograph of himself in happier circumstances. It was his graduation photograph from Quantico, and he had to smile at himself, resplendent then in blue high-necked blouse, two shiny gold bars, and the Mameluke sword. It was one of the few decent photographs ever taken of him.
Where did you get this? Your Marine chaps are most helpful to us. We had a merry time identifying you, Dr. Ryan.
The police had arrived in force at 8:30. By this time, Ryan had been able to eat his hospital breakfast and wash up.
We know about the accident and your discharge from the Corps. After that, you went into the brokerage business, made something of a name for yourself.
There were three police officers, very senior ones, Ryan thought, from the way Wilson snapped to his feet and scurried about to arrange chairs for them before excusing himself out the door.
After that, I gather you went back to school, Georgetown University, I believe, and took a doctorate in history. You've been teaching at the Naval Academy in Annapolis since 1980, is it?
James Owens appeared to be the most senior of the three. He reminded Ryan of his own father, a craggy, heavyset man, and judging from his large, gnarled hands, one who had earned his way to commander's rank after more than a few years of walking the streets and enforcing the law the hard way.
Of course, we also received a great deal of help from your wife as well.
Chief Superintendent William Taylor was about 40, younger than his anti-terrorist branch colleague and neater. Ryan thought they must have found Kathy to be a bit pushy.
Your wife also examined their Royal Highnesses on the scene, and that was most useful to us. She refused to leave your side until you were under competent medical care. We can hardly fault her for that.
Both senior detectives were well-dressed, and both had the red-rimmed eyes that come from an uninterrupted night's work. She did find our identification procedures a trifle long-winded, I'm afraid, and she was naturally quite anxious about you. David Ashley was the youngest and best-dressed of the three, about Ryan's size and weight, perhaps 5 years older. He described himself as a representative of the Home Office, and he looked a great deal smoother than either of the others. Our initial request to your legal attaché here was just before 5 p.m., and that made it noon in America, lunchtime, you see. It took us 3 hours to find out if you really were who your identification papers said you were. Ashley looked at the others for support. Owens took it up.
While all that was going on, we had to interview your wife several times to make sure she related everything she saw.
And she gave it to you exactly the same way every time, right?
Correct. That is quite remarkable, you know.
The interview had lasted about 2 hours. They had asked Jack about everything that had happened at least 3 times before they had allowed him to look at any of the newspapers.
The photographs are from a tourist half a block away with a telephoto lens. You might be interested to know that your Marine Corps thinks rather highly of you, by the way.
Owens consulted his notes.
Tied for first in your class at Quantico. Your fitness reports were excellent until the helicopter crash.
Ryan grinned.
So you're satisfied I'm a good guy?
The three men laughed. They had relaxed considerably in the course of the interview. Taylor explained.
We were convinced of that from the first moment. One must be thorough in major felony cases, however, and this one obviously had more than its share of complications. There's one thing that bothers me.
There was more than one, but Jack's brain was working too slowly to classify them all.
What the hell were they? The Royals, you call them? Doing out on the street with only a driver and one guard. That ambush was planned. This wasn't any accidental encounter. They had to hit a particular car in a particular place. Somebody had to time it out.
The Home Office man looked at Jack curiously. Just a historian, Dr. Ryan.
They teach you how to do ambushes in the Marines. Everybody learns the bare-bones stuff. I wasn't a specialist. Was this an assassination or an attempted kidnapping?
Owens responded quickly. We are not entirely sure. Ryan looked over his guests. He'd touched an open nerve. The attackers had disabled the car with a grenade, and they were carrying more of the same. If they just wanted to kill, he thought, they would not have taken so long. You just fibbed to me, Mr. Owens. This was definitely a kidnapped attempt, and you know it.
Why just one security man in the car, then? You have to protect your people better than that.
His mind was working faster now. What was it the papers had said? An unscheduled trip? The first requirement for a successful ambush is good intelligence. You can't pursue this, idiot. Commander Owens solved the problem for Jack.
Well, I believe we've covered everything rather nicely. We'll probably be back tomorrow.
They rose to leave. Ryan caught Taylor's eye. He thought he'd try another tack.
How are the terrorists? The one I wounded, I mean.
He has not been terribly cooperative. He won't speak to us at all, not even to tell us his name. The old story dealing with this lot. We've only identified him a few hours ago. No previous criminal record at all. His name appeared as a possible player in two minor cases, but nothing more than that. He is recovering quite nicely, and in 3 weeks or so, he would be taken before the Queen's Bench, tried before a jury of 12 good men and true, convicted and sentenced to spend the rest of his natural life in a secure prison.
Only 3 weeks? Ryan was surprised. Owens explained.
The case is clear-cut. We have only 3 photographs from our tourist friend that show this lad holding his gun behind the car, and 9 good eyewitnesses. There will be no mucking about with this lad.
And I'll be there to see it.
Of course. You will be our most important witness, Doctor. A formality, but a necessary one. And no claim of lunacy like the chap who tried to kill your president. This boy is a university graduate with honors, and he came from a good family.
Ryan shook his head against the pillow.
Ain't it a hell of a thing? But most of the really bad ones are, aren't they?
Ashley gave him another quizzical stare.
You know about terrorists?
Just things I've read.
That was a mistake, Jack. Cover it. Commander Owens was watching to see how he would handle this now.
Officer Wilson said the ULA were Maoists.
Taylor invited him to continue.
Correct.
That really is crazy. Hell, even the Chinese aren't Maoists anymore. At least, the last time I checked, they weren't. Oh, what about my family?
Ashley smiled. About time, you asked. We couldn't very well leave them at the hotel, could we? It was arranged for them to be put in a highly secure location. Owens agreed.
You need not be concerned. They're quite safe. My word on it.
40 minutes after the police left, Ryan was happily going over the notes he had made the day before, jotting down a few further reflections. He was working on a new book about tactical decision-making in combat situations, and his research had led him to the Admiralty Archive for signals between London and Admiral Sir James Somerville, who was commander of the British Indian Ocean Fleet in the early months of 1942. Kathy Ryan's most frequent and legitimate complaint about her husband was that while he was reading, or worse, writing, the world around him could end without his taking notice. This was not entirely true. Jack did notice Wilson jumping to attention out of the corner of his eye, but he did not look up until he had finished the new paragraph. When he did, he noticed that his new visitors were Her Majesty, the Queen of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, and her husband, the Duke of Edinburgh. His first coherent thought was a mental curse that no one had warned him. His second, that he must look very funny with his mouth hanging open.
Good morning, Dr. Ryan. How are you feeling?
Oh, quite well, thank you, Your Majesty. Won't you sit down?
Ryan tried to sit more erect in his bed, but was halted by a flash of pain from his shoulder.
We have no wish to impose.
Ryan sensed that she didn't want to leave right away, either. He took a second to frame his response.
Your Majesty, a visit from a head of state hardly qualifies as an imposition. I would be most grateful for your company.
The Queen was dressed in a peach-colored suit whose elegant simplicity must have made a noteworthy dent even in her clothing budget. The Duke was in a dark blue suit, which finally made Ryan understand why Kathy wanted to buy clothes for him over here.
Dr. Ryan, on our behalf and that of our people, we wish to express to you our most profound gratitude for your action of yesterday. We are very much in your debt.
Ryan nodded soberly. He wondered just how awful he looked, and he stammered out something about how glad he was to have been of service. Then the Duke spoke, and Jack remembered that this man had once been a professional naval officer. He had the look of a good one, too. They asked him why he had done it. There was considerable risk involved, after all, and he told them about his dad, who had been a police officer, and an Irish one at that. Jack couldn't speak to the Irish question, but he did feel strongly that terrorists were animals that didn't belong on the street. Yesterday, he simply saw a chance to do something, and he had taken it. When he had finished, the Queen nodded thoughtfully. She regarded Ryan with a warm, friendly smile for a few moments and turned to look to her husband. The two communicated without words. They had been married long enough for that, Ryan thought. When she turned back, he could see that a decision had been reached.
So then, how shall we reward you?
Reward, madam? Thank you very much. That's not necessary. I'm glad I was able to help. That's enough.
No, Dr. Ryan, it's not enough. One of the nicer things about being queen is that one is permitted to recognize meritorious conduct, then to reward it properly. The crown cannot appear to be ungrateful.
Her eyes sparkled with some private joke.
Accordingly, it has been decided that you, John Patrick Ryan, shall be invested as a knight commander of the Victorian Order.
Ryan blinked a few times as his brain tried to catch up with his ears.
The Prime Minister will be discussing this with your president later today. For the purposes of American law, it will probably be considered honorary, but for our purposes it will be quite real.
Ryan fumbled for something to say.
Well, Your Majesty, insofar as it does not conflict with the laws of my country, I will be deeply honored to accept.
The Queen beamed.
That settles it then, Sir John. And when you are fully recovered, I hope that you will do us the honor of joining Lady Ryan and your delightful daughter as our personal guests at the palace.
Jack's jaw dropped to his chest. Lady Ryan? The palace?
It was the least thing we could do. The palace is secure, and we have ample room for guests, I assure you. When we left, your wife and child were fast asleep, and we left strict instructions that they were not to be disturbed.
Oh, Lord!
The Duke appeared truly concerned. You have an objection? My little girl, well, she's very good at breaking things, especially valuable things. She's kind of a tornado, in fact. Olivia, she's a very lovely child. So it was Olivia, was it? The name had been a peace offering to Kathy's family that hadn't worked. It was the name of her grandmother. But to Jack and Kathy, she was just Sally. Her Majesty feigned shock.
I fear you exaggerate, Sir John.
There was no arguing with a queen. Six 600 miles away, a Sabena flight was landing just outside of Cork. The passenger in seat 23D of the Boeing 737 was entirely unremarkable. His sandy hair was cut medium close, and he was dressed like a middle-level executive in a neat but rumpled suit that gave the impression of a man who'd spent too long on the job and gotten too little sleep before catching a flight home. If asked, he could have given a convincing discourse on the wholesale fish business and the accent of Southern Ireland. He read the London Times on the flight, and the topic of discussion in his seat row, as with the rest of the aircraft, was the story which covered the front page.
A terrible thing,
he'd agreed with the man in 23F, a Belgian dealer in machine tools, who could not have known how an event could be terrible in more ways than one. All the months of planning, the painstakingly gathered intelligence, the rehearsals, the 3 escape routes, all for nothing because of this bloody meddler. He examined the photo on the front page.
Who are you, Yank?
John Patrick Ryan, historian.
A bloody academic, ex-marine. Trust a damn bootneck to stick his nose where it doesn't belong.
John Patrick Ryan, you're a bloody Catholic, aren't you? Well, Johnny nearly put paid on your account. Too bad about Johnny. Good man Johnny was, dependable, loved his guns, and true to the cause. The plane finally came to a stop on the runway. Forward, the stewardess opened the door and the passengers rose to get their bags from the overhead storage. The man in 23D folded his newspaper, rose, and joined the slow movement forward. This operation had been so important, so much planning. We'll just have to try again, that's all. We can afford to be patient. We only have to be lucky once, he said to himself. The men in the H blocks weren't going anywhere. But what about Sean? Mistake to have taken him along. He'd planned the operation from the beginning. Sean knows a great deal about the organization. He set that worry aside as he stepped off the aircraft. Sean would never talk. Ryan's next visitor was the Prince of Wales. Wilson snapped to his feet again, and Jack wondered if the kid's knees were tiring of this. Nurse Kittywake had been in only 5 minutes before to administer some medication, and it was already working. Ryan's shoulder was drifting farther away, but along with this came a feeling of lightheadedness as from a couple of stiff drinks. He smiled broadly.
Howdy. How are you feeling, sir?
The prince looked very tired, his thin face stretched an extra inch or so, with a lingering sadness around the eyes. His shoulders drooped within the conservative gray suit.
Quite well, thank you.
The answering smile contained no enthusiasm.
Why don't you sit down, sir? You look as though you've had a tougher night than I did. Yes, thank you, Dr. Ryan.
He made another attempt to smile. It failed. The prince's words did not come easily. He had trouble looking up from his chair. So Ryan did most of the talking. He understood at once how the young man felt. The prince had been through the service schools, qualified as a pilot, parachuted out of airplanes. He'd even commanded his own ship. And when the chips were down, there had been nothing he could do but duck and try to protect his family.
Why, you did exactly the right thing, goddammit.
The prince flushed a bit, and Ryan wondered if they could take a knighthood back. He decided to press on.
You knew what your options were, and you used your head and took the best one you had. There is nothing, repeat, nothing for you to feel badly about. And if you don't believe me, ask Wilson. He's a cop.
The anti-terrorist branch officer cleared his throat. He had turned several shades of pale during Ryan's speech, but he was now somewhat recovered.
Excuse me, Your Royal Highness, but Dr. Ryan is quite correct. We were discussing this problem yesterday, and we reached precisely the same conclusion.
Ryan looked over to the cop.
How long did you kick that idea around, Tony?
Perhaps 10 minutes.
That's 600 seconds, Your Highness. But you had to act in what, 5, maybe 3? Not much time to make a life and death decision, is it? Mister, I'd say you did damn well. All that training you've picked up along the line worked, and if you were evaluating someone else's performance instead of your own, you'd say the same thing.
Jack could see the young man's mind going over what he had just been told. His Highness was sitting a little straighter now.
But the press. Screw the press. What do reporters know about anything? People in that business could use some manners, and people in your business are entitled to some privacy, just like the rest of us.
The prince was smiling now.
And what of your manners, Sir John? Mea maxima culpa, my lord prince. You got me there. Still, we might not be here except for you. On behalf of my family and myself, I thank you.
The two men continued to talk, and eventually the discussion came around to children. The prince had met Kathy and Sally, of course, and Jack said how much he was looking forward to meeting the princess and their small child. They exchanged invitations to visit at a future date. It occurred to Ryan as the prince was leaving that it was probably the royal baby the terrorists had been after, but he didn't mention it. After all he had done to cheer His Highness up, there was no point in bringing up things like that. But how had they known the baby would be in that car? And then came the most important visit of all, with Sally charging into the room and springing into his bed to kiss him, and Kathy only a few steps behind. There were other visitors as well, together with flowers and invitations to dinner. Ryan's doctor stopped in and pronounced him doing well, which seemed both to please and to annoy Nurse Kittywake. There was altogether too much coming and going here for her patient's good, and she wanted it to be known that she didn't approve. The following day, the press were allowed in, and Jack did his best to cooperate.
The morning papers had carried reports that Ryan was a former or current employee of the Central Intelligence Agency, something that was not technically true, and that Jack had not expected to become public in any case.
I read that this morning. It was as much a surprise to me as it was to anyone else.
So you deny that report?
Ryan smiled at the man from the Daily Mirror.
I'm not good-looking enough to be a spy.
The report comes from some highly placed sources.
If you read a little history, you'll see that highly placed folks have been known to make mistakes. I think that's what's happened here. I teach, I write books, I lecture. I did give a lecture at CIA once, but that was just a repeat of the one I gave at the Naval War College and one other symposium. It wasn't even classified. Maybe that's where the report comes from. I think somebody just goofed.
Somebody goofed, all right.
I can get you guys a copy of the lecture. It's no big deal.
And what of your perspective as an Irish-American on the Troubles?
One of the television people this time.
We have enough problems of our own in America without having to borrow yours.
Surely you have a suggestion. Most Americans do.
I teach history. I'll let other people make it. It's like being a reporter. I get to criticize people long after they make their decisions. That doesn't mean I know what to do today.
But you knew what to do on Tuesday.
Yes, I guess I did.
So you think we should solve it? How do you propose we begin?
You clever bastard. Bloody historian. Don't even know what's going on, do you?
Kevin Joseph O'Donnell muttered into a glass of dark Guinness beer. He turned away from the Sony television and gazed out the leaded glass windows to the darkness of the sea. His base of operation was much further from the border than any might have expected. Ireland is a small country, and distances are but relative things, particularly to those with all the resources they need. His former colleagues in the PIRA had extensive safe houses along the border. They were not for O'Donnell. The Provo fools had kicked him out, and the border could be a convenience to either side. He saw the running lights of a car ferry inbound from Le Havre. The view was always a fine one. Even in the limited visibility of an ocean storm, one could savor the fundamental force of nature as the gray waves battered the rocky cliff. Now the clear, cold air gave him a view of the star-defined horizon, and he spied another merchant ship heading eastward for an unknown port. It pleased O'Donnell that this stately house had once belonged to a British lord. It pleased him more that he'd been able to purchase it through a dummy corporation, that there were few questions asked when cash and a reputable solicitor were involved.
So shallow they are, so lacking in political awareness.
Someday they would all disappear, just as one of those ships slid beneath the horizon. History was an inevitable process. O'Donnell was sure of that. The cause didn't require much, not really. A clear ideological objective. A few good men. Friends, the right friends, with access to the right resources. That was all. A public political wing, Sinn Féin, electing people to Parliament. What rubbish. Valuable political targets declared off limits, and people wondered why the provos were getting nowhere. Their ideology was bankrupt, and there were too many people in the brigade. When the Brits caught some, a few were bound to turn tout and inform on their comrades. The kind of commitment needed for this sort of job demanded an elite few. O'Donnell had that all right.
Bloody bastards pleased with himself.
O'Donnell turned to see a fresh bottle of Guinness offered. He took it.
Sean should have watched his back. Then this bloody hero would be a corpse. We can still do something about that, sir.
O'Donnell shook his head. We did not waste our energy on the insignificant. The provos had been doing that for 10 years, and look where it had gotten them.
What if he's CIA? What if we'd been infiltrated and he was...
Don't be a bloody fool. If they had been tipped, every peeler in London would have been there in plain clothes waiting for us. And I would have known beforehand. O'Donnell didn't say it. Only one other member of the organization knew his source, and he was in London. The rare bookshop was in the Burlington Arcade, a century-old promenade of shops off the most fashionable part of Piccadilly. It was sandwiched between one of London's custom tailors. This one catered mainly to tourists, and a jeweler.
Morning, Mr. Cooley. And to you, sir.
The owner of the shop, Mr. Dennis Cooley, answered one of his regulars as he stood.
He had an accent so neutral that his customers had him pegged as a native of three different regions.
I have the first edition Defoe, the one you called about earlier this week. Just came in yesterday. Is this the one from that collection in Cork you spoke about?
No, sir. I believe it's an original from the estate of Sir John Claggett near Swaffham Prior. I found it at Hofstons in Cambridge.
Mr. Cooley traveled a great deal, often flying out on short notice to attend the auction of some deceased gentleman's library, leaving the shop to the custody of a young lady who would have been quite pretty if she'd worked at it a little harder. Beatrix was off today.
Is this the first edition?
Most certainly, sir.
The book dealer did not react noticeably. The code phrase was both constant and changing. When the customer mentioned a county in the Irish Republic, that was the destination. When he questioned the edition of the book, he also indicated its importance. Cooley pulled the book off the shelf and set it on the desk.
I must have it. How much?
The dealer didn't answer. Instead, he removed a card from a filing box and handed it to the customer. The customer only gave the card a cursory look.
Done.
The customer sat down in the store's only chair and opened his briefcase.
I have another job for you. This is an early copy of The Vigor of Wakefield. I found it last month at a little shop in Cornwall.
Then there had been the visit of the legal attaché at the embassy, Dan Murray. FBI, sorry I couldn't get down sooner, but things have been a little busy. Murray had a flower box tucked under his arm. He showed his ID to the cop sitting in with Ryan. Tony Wilson was off duty. The cop excused himself. Murray took his seat.
Looking good, Ace.
You could have left the flowers at the desk. Ryan gestured around the room. Despite efforts on his part to have the flowers spread about the hospital, he could barely see the walls for all the roses. The FBI man grinned.
I figured that. How does a Whopper and fries grab you?
Jack laughed and grabbed. Murray wanted to talk to Jack about the trial of the ULA man. He also brought greetings from the ambassador.
He wanted to come over, but they have a big-time party on for later tonight. My friends from down the hall send their regards, too.
Jack swallowed a few fries.
Who down the hall?
The people you never worked for. The FBI agent raised his eyebrows.
Oh?
Speculation about Jack's link to CIA had subsided following the press conference. Murray congratulated him on his performance.
I told the truth, barely. Fortunately, whoever got hold of the story didn't get the whole story. An outfit called Mitra Corporation held the consulting contract. All my paychecks came through them.
Murray nodded.
I saw a copy of your report. Came over here a few months ago.
So their cops know. The FBI agent chuckled.
I'm not so sure. Owens probably does. He's anti-terrorist. Ashley as well. He's in MI5. You'll have to admit it struck a few people as slightly curious. The guy who wrote Agents and Agencies gets stuck in the middle of the terrorist operation. That's why Ashley showed up.
Admiral James Greer hit the off button on the remote control as the cable news network switched topics.
Well, Judge?
The director of Central Intelligence tapped his cigar in a cut-glass ashtray.
We know he's smart, James, and it looks like he knows how to handle himself with reporters, but he's impetuous.
It was drizzling outside the seventh-floor window of the office of the Deputy Director, Intelligence of the Central Intelligence Agency. The rolling hills of the Potomac Valley prevented his seeing the river, but he could spy the hills a mile or so away on the far side. He turned to address his superior.
Come on, Arthur, he's young. I want somebody in here with some fresh ideas. Are you going to tell me now that you didn't like his report? First time at bat and he turns out something that good?
Judge Moore smiled behind his cigar.
Background check?
Greer sensed he was getting somewhere.
In progress. Began it just as soon as this business started up.
The Admiral held up the telex from London.
He takes his clearance seriously, and he's asking some good questions. Emil says his man Murray was impressed, too. It's a damn shame to waste him teaching history.
Judge Moore smiled.
Even at your alma mater?
That does hurt a little, yes.
The Admiral knew he was almost home free.
Well, there's no hurry, and who knows, maybe he'll come to us. I wouldn't put it past him to come in here asking for a chance to research this ULA outfit. If he does, I'll pop the question.
The day Ryan was released from the hospital was the happiest in his life, at least since Sally had been born in Johns Hopkins 4 years before. Virtually the whole floor staff was lined up in the hall along with a number of the patients Ryan had in the past week and a half. Nurse Kittywake hugged him, cast and all, before helping him into the Rolls Royce that would take him to Buckingham Palace. The guest room, which he would now share with his wife, was about the size of the living dining room in their house back home. His things had all been brought over from the hotel, and Kathy had ordered a few suits to be made up for him, including a tux, modified to accommodate his caste, which would be just right for the reception planned in his honor. There were about 30 people there, Ryan judged, and the moment they entered, all conversation stopped. Everyone turned to stare at Ryan. Jack had a terrible urge to slink away. He needed a drink.
"Good evening, Sir John."
A man in the uniform of a vice admiral of the Royal Navy. He realized belatedly that a lot of people came here for the first time, but few would be received as warmly or as personally as he. There were a number of military types, a former chief of the British Secret Intelligence Service. Ryan thought he recognized him from his stint at Langley. And several of them offered sincere praise for agents and agencies. So that is known over here, Ryan thought, as he was introduced to Jeffrey Watkins of the Foreign Office.
Liaison officer between the Foreign Office and the Royal Family. Nothing like the glamour one might expect. Mainly I carry the dispatch box and try to hide in corners.
Ryan smiled. He could identify with that. Something caught Watkins' eye. Ryan was facing the wrong way to see what it was, but the reactions were plain enough. The group around him began to disengage, with Watkins making his way off first. Jack turned in time to see the Queen appear at the door, accompanied by the Duke. The Queen came first to him.
"You're looking much better, Sir John."
Jack tried to bow. He thought he was supposed to.
"Thank you, Your Majesty. I feel much better. Good evening, sir."
One thing about shaking hands with the Duke, you knew there was a man at the other end.
"Hello again, Jack. Do try to be at ease. This is completely informal. No receiving lines, no protocol. Relax."
They moved into an adjoining room for dinner. "If ever there was a pig in the manger," thought Jack, "it's me." But he was astonished to find that he was made to feel truly welcome by all. The only other surprise of the evening came in a brief aside with his wife, during which she informed him that she was pregnant. "Remember when we first got here, as soon as we put Sally down to bed? It's those strange hotel beds, Jack. They do it every time." The next 2 weeks passed like a dream. Their vacation finally began, and it was wonderful, although not at all as planned. They had a special escort wherever they went. "It sure is different to visit castles and palaces all day and then return to sleep in one," Jack remarked one evening as he and Kathy were dressing for dinner. And then there was the trial. Preliminary testimony lasted for about 2 hours while Ryan sat on a marble bench outside Old Bailey's number 2 courtroom, and then he was on. The defendant's name was Sean Miller, not a particularly Irish name to Ryan's way of thinking. He was 26, short, slender, dressed neatly in a suit and tie. He was smiling up at someone in the visitor's gallery while Ryan described what had happened. When Ryan identified the defendant as the man he had attacked, Miller's gaze shifted, and Ryan examined him for the first time. Sean Miller's gray eyes didn't blink. He must have practiced that as they bored into him from 30 feet away. Ryan returned the stare, careful to keep his face without expression. And while the court reporter finished up his transcription of Jack's testimony and the visitors in the overhead gallery whispered observations, Ryan and Miller were all alone, testing each other's wills. What's behind those eyes, Jack wondered. No weakling, to be sure. This was a game, Miller's game, that he'd practiced before, Ryan thought with certainty. There was strength in there, like something one might encounter in a predatory animal. But there was nothing to mute the strength. There was none of the softness of morality or conscience, only strength and will. He was a predator looking at a thing and wondering how he might reach it.
A wounded animal will always seek out its tormentor, Jack told himself. And this wounded animal has a brain. This one has a memory. This one is thinking. Ryan was frightened in a way he'd never known before. The feeling lasted several seconds before he reminded himself that Miller would be sentenced to prison for the rest of his natural life, and that prison life would change the person or thing that lived behind those pale gray eyes. And I used to be a Marine, Jack told himself. I'm not afraid of you. I can handle you, punk. I took you out once, didn't I? He smiled at Miller, just a slight curve at the corner of his mouth. Nasty, but not that much to worry about, he told himself. Jack turned away as though from an exhibit at the zoo. He wondered if Miller had seen through his quiet bravado. Ryan's first day back at work was easier than he had expected. His prolonged absence had forced the history department to reassign his classes, and in any case, it was almost time for Christmas break, and nearly all the midshipmen were looking forward to going home for the holidays. Class routine was slightly relaxed, and even the plebes enjoyed a respite from the upperclassmen's harassment in the wake of the win over Army. He'd arrived at his office at 7:30. By 4:45, he'd dealt with almost all of his paperwork, and Ryan felt that he delivered an honest day's work. He was finishing a set of test questions for the semester's final exam when he smelled cheap cigar smoke and heard a familiar voice.
"Did you enjoy your vacation, boy?"
Lieutenant Commander Robert Jefferson Jackson was leaning against the door frame.
"It had a few interesting moments, Robbie, but it's nice to be back."
Robbie set his white cap on top of Ryan's filing cabinet and collapsed into a leather armchair opposite his friend's desk.
"Glad you made it, Jack. You kind of worried us. How's the arm?"
"Better than it was. You ought to see the cast I started out with. They took it off at Hopkins last Friday. Still's a bitch driving a stick through Annapolis with one arm."
"I'll bet. Damn if you ain't crazy, boy."
Ryan nodded agreement. He'd met Jackson the previous March at a faculty tea. Robbie wore the gold wings of a naval aviator. He'd been assigned to the nearby Patuxent River Naval Air Test Center, Maryland, as an instructor until a faulty relay had unexpectedly blasted him clear of the Buckeye jet trainer he'd been flying one fine clear morning. Unprepared for the event, he'd broken his leg badly, and the Navy had assigned him to temporary duty as an instructor in the engineering department at Annapolis.
"Any news on campus?"
Jackson tapped the cigar on Ryan's ashtray.
"Still teaching the boys and girls."
"And you've started to like it?"
"Not exactly. The leg's finally back in battery, though. I've been spending my weekends down at Pax River to prove I still know how to fly."
Jackson was shorter than Ryan and much darker. He was the fourth son of a Baptist preacher in southern Alabama. When they'd first met, the pilot was still in a cast, but Jackson had asked Ryan if he might want to try his hand at kendo. It was something that Ryan had never tried, the Japanese fencing sport in which bamboo staves are used in place of samurai swords. He'd accepted the invitation, thinking that his longer reach would be a decisive advantage, particularly on top of Jackson's reduced mobility. Ryan soon learned that Jackson had the blinding quickness and the killer instinct of a rattlesnake. By the time the bruises had faded, they were fast friends.
"How's Kathy and Sally?"
"We meant to come over Sunday, but we had to drive up to Philadelphia on short notice."
Ryan smiled. "It was kind of tough on them, but they came through all right." The pilot frowned. The funny thing about Robbie, Jack knew, was his caution. For all the down-home bantering about his life as a fighter pilot, Jackson never took a risk he didn't have to.
"You got a family to worry about, Jack. Leave that rescue stuff to the professionals."
"It's all over, Rob. It's behind me, and there won't be a next time." Robbie chuckled.
"We'll put a big Roger on that. Who else am I going to drink with? And speaking of which..."
The two men looked at their watches together, then at each other, and then they both burst out laughing. They rose to leave.
"Is it true about Kathy?"
Ryan beamed.
"Yep, the doc confirmed it the same day they took the cast off." "Way to go, Pop, and it's definitely my turn to buy."
Driving wasn't easy. When he shifted, Ryan twisted his left hand inside the sling to grab the wheel while his right hand worked the gears. His rabbit had five plus reverse. Is this worth an extra 2 miles per gallon? Ryan laughed at himself as he headed east toward the Chesapeake Bay, then right onto Falcon's Nest Road. There was rarely any traffic back here. Falcon's Nest Road came to a dead end, not too far down from Ryan's place, and on the other side of the road were several farms, dormant now as winter approached.
The end of term had arrived, and Christmas was upon them. Kathy would pick Sally up from nursery school in another hour. He had plenty of time to unload the back seat of the car, which right now was crammed with large boxes of toys. He turned left into his driveway. Ryan had 30 acres on Peregrine Cliff. His nearest neighbor was a half a mile away through heavily wooded slopes and across a murky stream. The cliffs on the western shore of the Chesapeake were 50 feet high where Jack lived and made of crumbly sandstone. They were a paleontologist's delight, but they were also terribly prone to erosion. Not long ago, the state environmental protection people had persuaded Ryan and his neighbors to plant kudzu, a prolific weed from the American South. The weed had stabilized the cliff face, but it was also attacking the trees near the cliff. Jack had to go at them periodically with weed killer to save the trees from being smothered, but that wasn't a problem at this time of year. Part of the Ryan family tradition, a tradition barely 3 years old, but a tradition nevertheless, was that after Sally was in bed and asleep, her parents would creep down into the basement and bring the toys upstairs for assembly. The previous 2 years, this ceremony had been accompanied by a couple of bottles of champagne. This year, he and Kathy only had one, and Jack had to drink almost all of it. "One glass is the weekly limit now, Jack," she reminded him, "and I did have a big glass." Christmas morning came at last. Jack had brought his wife a necklace of fine gold, more than a quarter of an inch wide, designed to fit closely around the neck. Figuring out women's fashion was not his strongest point. He'd gotten advice from Sissy Jackson and a very patient clerk at the jewelry store. Kathy loved it. The Jacksons came over for dinner, and as usual, they had a wonderful time together. Of course, the house looked like a Toys R Us that got nuked. Robbie and Jack sat in the living room looking out at the vast emptiness of the bay. In front of them, Sally was playing with her new toys. She was winding down at last, as were Jack and Kathy, after only 5 hours of sleep. That was a little tough on a pregnant wife, Jack had thought an hour earlier, and he and Robbie had cleared away the dishes, now being processed in the dishwasher in the kitchen. Their wives were on the other couch talking. "God, I need a stretch." Jack stood up and beckoned his friend to the stairs. Robbie checked to see that Sally was out of earshot.
"Being Santa's a bitch, isn't it? If you could put all those toys together, maybe I ought to turn you loose on my airplane."
"Wait till I have both arms back." Jack pulled his arm out of the sling and moved it around as they went down to the library level. He flipped on the lights.
"Should be okay in another few months. Want to catch the news?"
Ryan flipped on the small TV on his desk. Cable had made it down his road, and he was already hooked on CNN. It was so nice to get the national and world news when you wanted. It was a few minutes short of the hourly headlines. Jack left the sound down.
"How about you, getting back in shape?"
"They don't pay me to lose, son." The pilot grinned like a sleepy lion.
"Nice to see such confidence." "There's better pilots than me. Three, as a matter of fact. Ask me again in a year when I'm back in the groove."
"Oh, yeah?" Jack laughed. The laugh died when he saw the picture on the TV screen. It was Sean Miller. The photograph was not new. He had seen it in the papers at the time of the trial. The picture on the screen changed to show the weather on the English Channel and a Royal Navy helicopter circling, evidently searching the stormy waters below. Ryan knew at once what they must be looking for.
The terrorists escaped, killing four police officers. An intense land, sea, and air search is underway for the men who snatched their convicted comrade while en route to a British prison on the Isle of Wight. Sean Miller was convicted only 3 weeks ago in the daring attack on the Prince and Princess of Wales within sight of Buckingham Palace. The driver and a security man, as well as one of the terrorists, were killed before the attack was broken up by American tourist Jack Ryan of Annapolis, Maryland.
The picture changed again to a file tape of Miller being taken out of the Old Bailey. Just before he was put in the police van, Miller turned to face the camera, and now, 3 weeks later, his eyes stared again into those of John Patrick Ryan.
"You shouldn't blame yourself, Jimmy. Besides, no one could have picked him up in that weather. They couldn't have made it."
James Owens wasn't in the mood for a pep talk.
"Just what percentage of your salary would you wager on that hypothesis, eh, Danny boy?"
Dan Murray could see that the head of C-13 still looked upon this as a very personal defeat.
"Not very much. So you think a ship picked them up?" "It's the only thing that makes the least bit of sense. 9 merchant vessels were close enough to have been involved. We have the list."
So did Murray.
It had already been forwarded to Washington, where the FBI and the CIA would both work on it. Any breaks on the leak? The American legal attaché had touched the rawest nerve of all. He'd better pray we don't catch him. There was as yet no danger that this would happen. There had been a total of 31 people who had known the time and the route for the prisoner transfer, and 5 of them were dead. Even the driver of the van hadn't known beforehand. That left 26, every one of them with a top-drawer security clearance. Not that a clearance matters a damn, Owens told himself again. By definition, a leak had to come from a bastard with a top-drawer clearance. But this was different. This was treason. It was worse than treason, a concept Owens hadn't even thought possible until the last week. You're right that they should have protected their intelligence source after the attempt on the Royals. I know you'll get him, Jimmy. I will put money down on that. The Englishman walked over to Murray's cabinet and found a bottle of whiskey, a Christmas present, still unopened on New Year's Eve. He poured 2 drinks. In the past year, Owens had broken his American colleague of the need to put ice in everything. It was shameful to contaminate single malt Scotch whiskey. They drank together in silence. Owen frowned at another recurring thought. What does that tell us about Sean Miller? Murray stretched his arms out. More important than you thought, maybe. That's what Ashley thinks. The FBI man set down his empty glass and began locking up his files. Jimmy, do yourself a favor and give it a night off. Clear the old head out and start fresh in the morning. Owen smiled. I'll try. He picked up his overcoat and walked towards the door. One last thing. It hit me on the drive over. These chaps, the ULA, they've broken all the rules, haven't they? Dan Murray went on closing up, allowing Owens to finish his thought. There's only one rule they haven't broken. Murray turned. Oh, yeah? What's that? They've never done anything in America. Jimmy, why did you say that? Murray asked himself as he let himself into his flat in Kensington. No Irish terrorist group had ever operated in the United States. Sure, they raised money there in the Irish neighborhoods and saloons of Boston and New York, made the odd speech about their vision of a free, united Ireland, never bothering to say that as committed Marxist-Leninists, their vision of Ireland was of another Cuba. They had always been shrewd enough to know that Irish Americans might not feel comfortable with that little detail. And there was the gun running. The PIRA and the INLA currently got most of their weapons on the world open market. There were also reports that some of their people had gotten training in Soviet military camps. You couldn't tell a man's nationality from a satellite photograph, nor could you recognize a specific face. These reports had never been confirmed sufficiently to be released to the press. The same was true of the camps in Libya and Syria and Lebanon. Some people, fair-skinned people, were being trained there, but who? Murray realized that the bottom line was still that the PIRA and the INLA had never committed a crime in America. Never. Not once. But Jimmy was right. The ULA had never hesitated to break a rule. The royal family was off limits to everyone else, but not the ULA. The PIRA and the INLA always advertised their operations, but not the ULA. He shook his head. Not the sort of thing to start an investigation with. But what are they up to? He said aloud as he took off his coat. His wife found him dialing the phone, a ferocious scowl on his face. She wondered what was wrong. As you see, ladies and gentlemen, the decision Nelson made in this case had a long-term effect of finally putting an end to the stultifying influence of the Royal Navy's formal tactics. There is nothing like a decisive victory to teach people a lesson. Questions? Dr. Ryan, given the fact that the Royal Navy's formal tactics did have a stultifying effect on decision-making at the command level, what if Nelson hadn't won the day, sir? It was Jack's first day back at teaching class. There was snow on the ground this frigid January day, and he had had to watch for patches of ice on the brick sidewalk of the Naval Academy as he made his way to Bancroft Hall. His thoughts had been elsewhere. Bill Shaw from the Washington office of the FBI had paid him a visit earlier in the day at the request of his friend and colleague Dan Murray. I got a call last week from Dan. He's a little, I wish to emphasize this, only a little concerned that the ULA might, well, they don't have much of a reason to like you, Dr. Ryan. Jack had taken the man's card and watched him leave. He had tried to call Murray but couldn't get through.
He was deep in thought when Robbie Jackson entered his office a half hour later. Ryan explained.
This ULA outfit is unpredictable. That's what Dan Murray told me at the time. That's what makes them dangerous. Jackson had taken him over to the Lejeune Annex across from the Halsey Fieldhouse where the Academy's new pistol range was housed. Ryan owned a Remington 1100 automatic 12-gauge, which he frequently took out for ducks and geese. He had missed out the last season, of course. Gunnery Sergeant Major Noah Breckenridge was impressed.
Good for a start. That's your at-home gun. Nothing beats a shotgun at close range. You have a deer slug barrel? No? Well, you're going to get one of those. I think I'll start you off on a 9mm Browning for your personal sidearm. It's got a 13-shot clip. Your hand looks big enough to hold it. Got a nice safety, too. If you have a kid in the house, Lieutenant, you better think about safety, okay? About your wife. Look, just bring her over some Saturday. I'll set her down and talk to her about these things.
Ryan wondered what Kathy would say. She had never once touched his shotgun, and whenever he cleaned it, she kept Sally out of the room. Jack hadn't minded that. Little kids and firearms were not a happy mixture. At home, he usually kept the Remington disassembled and the ammunition locked away in the basement. How would Kathy react to having a loaded gun in the house? Ryan signed up for some hours of practice at the range, and Robbie walked him back to his office. After his friend left, Ryan stared at his telephone for several minutes. Somehow he'd managed to avoid doing this for several weeks despite his wish to track down information on the ULA. But it wasn't just curiosity anymore. Ryan flipped open his telephone book and turned to the G page. He was able to call the D.C. area direct, though his finger hesitated before it jammed down on each button.
This is Mrs. Cummings.
Hello, Nancy. This is Dr. Ryan. Is the boss in?
Let me check. Can you hold for a second?
Yes. They didn't have one of the musical hold buttons at CIA, Ryan noted. There was just the muted chirp of electronic noises for him to listen to. Am I doing the right thing, he wondered. He admitted to himself that he didn't know.
Jack.
Hello, Admiral.
How's the family? They came through all the excitement all right?
They're just fine, sir.
And I understand that your wife's expecting another baby. Congratulations.
And how did he know that, Jack wondered. The DDI was supposed to know everything, of course, and there were at least a million ways he might have found out. Thank you, sir.
So what can I do for you?
Admiral, I just want to look into this ULA bunch.
Yeah, I thought you might. When do you want to come over?
Why was he making it so easy? Too easy, Jack thought. Could I come over tomorrow morning?
No problem. Be at the main gate at 8 a.m. They'll be waiting for you.
The drive home that day was a troubled one. Jack watched his rearview mirror, although he didn't know what he was looking for. Should he start changing the routes he took every day, as Bill Shaw had suggested? And what was he going to tell Kathy? Paranoid. All this is paranoid, he told himself as he fought his way up Route 2 into Annapolis. And what if it's not? That's why I'm going to Langley tomorrow, Ryan answered himself. So, it's decided then. Kevin O'Donnell looked at the younger man, knowing why the plan had been formulated. It was a good plan, he admitted to himself, but Sean had allowed personal feelings to influence his judgment. That wasn't good. He turned to the window. The French countryside below was dark, 30,000 feet below the airliner. All those peaceful people sleeping in their homes, safe and secure. They were on a red-eye flight, and the plane was nearly empty. They had been careful to cover their tracks. First the flight from Tripoli to Bucharest, then to Prague, then to Paris, and now the flight home to Ireland, with only French entry stamps in their passports. O'Donnell was a careful man to the point of carrying notes on his fictitious meetings with two frozen seafood packagers in France. They'd get through customs easily enough, O'Donnell was sure. Sean had a completely new passport with the proper stamps, of course. He now wore brown contact lenses, and a neatly trimmed beard changed the shape of his face. Sean hated the beard for its itching. O'Donnell smiled at the darkness. Well, he'd have to get used to that. Sean didn't say anything else. He sat back and pretended to read the magazine he'd found in the seat pocket. The young man had gone through his refresher training with a passion, trimming off the excess weight, reacquainting himself with his weapons, conferring with the intelligence officers from organizations in other fair-skinned nations, and living through their critique of the failed operation in London. These friends had pointed out that another car of men had been needed to ensure success.
through all of it, Sean had kept his peace and listened politely, and now he waited patiently for the decision on his proposed operation. Perhaps the young man had learned something in that English jail. O'Donnell turned to him and smiled. Yes. It was barely a year since the ULA had emerged from the shadows to take some kind of shape. The first year they'd operated, it was thought by the British that they were a PIRA special action group, a Provo hit squad. Based on operational patterns, the group seemed to be organized on military lines. That's interesting, Ryan thought, putting down the report. Military training, ? He wrote down. How good, where done. He looked at the next report. It was dated some months after the first, and it showed a greater degree of institutional interest. CIA had begun to take a closer look at the ULA, starting 7 months previously. Right after I left here, Jack noted. Coincidence. This report concentrated on Kevin O'Donnell, biography, operational history in PIRA. He flipped forward in time to O'Donnell's departure from the Provos. Here the information from British sources was fairly complete. O'Donnell had been remarkably effective as chief of internal security. Nearly half of the people he'd killed really had been informers of one sort or another. Not a bad percentage in this sort of business. He found a couple of new pages at the end of the report. O'Donnell got a little carried away. He had used his position to eliminate provos whose politics weren't as far left as his own. It had been discovered, and he had vanished. 2 years later, the name of the ULA surfaces. Rivalry with PIRA, ? Ryan turned when he heard someone working on the lock of his office door. It was Marty Canner, executive assistant in Admiral Greer's office. Marty had been delegated to show Ryan around, supply whatever documents he asked for, provided, of course, that he did not stray too far from ULA-related matters. Everything okay? Ryan nodded. This O'Donnell character is one formidable son of a bitch. He's got his organization trained like a real army. He's a political animal, but he knows how to think and plan like a soldier. Who trained him? Nobody knows. Did Ryan note a slight hesitation? Marty continued. I think you can overestimate that factor, though. Next, who is the ULA's political target? And how come just about all of what we know about the organization comes from provos? Canter grinned. Let me know when you've figured that one out. Can I talk to anybody about this? Like who? I just want to ask before I say no. Like Dan Murray, the legal attaché in London. He's supposed to be cleared all the way on this material, isn't he? Canter thought for a moment. Yes, he is, and he works with our people, too. Okay, you can talk with him. That keeps it in the family. 5 minutes later, Canter was sitting across from Admiral Greer's desk. He really knows how to ask the right questions. So, what did he tumble to? The same questions that Emil Jacobs and the team over at the FBI have been asking. What's O'Donnell up to, and where does he stand vis-a-vis the PIRA? Greer nodded. Anything else? The training stuff. He hasn't sifted through all the data yet. I think we should give him some time, but you were right, sir. He's plenty sharp. The storm was magnificent. Miller and O'Donnell stood by the leaded glass windows and watched the Atlantic gale beat the sea to foaming waves that slammed against the cliff on which the house stood.
Not a day to be sailing, Sean.
O'Donnell sipped at his whiskey. Then he turned to look at his chief of operations.
When do our colleagues go to America?
3 weeks. The ULA leader thought the timing marginal for what Sean planned.
Not much time. Do you still want to do it? This is not an opportunity to be missed, Kevin.
O'Donnell agreed, but he had doubts. Better to get them in the open.
Do you have another motive?
Miller struggled to appear calm, objective.
Consider the ramifications. The provisionals go over to proclaim their innocence and ask for a continued support, and bang.
Yes, I know. It's a fine opportunity. Very well. When do you want to leave?
Wednesday morning. It won't move quickly. Even with our contacts, it won't be easy.
The two men hunched over the blow-up of the map, flanked by several 8x10 photographs of Gate Number 3 of the United States Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland.
What's the problem?
Sean Miller could see it himself, but by asking the question, he could also gauge the skill of his new associate. He had never worked with a black before, and though he'd met Alex and a member of his group the year before, both were unknown quantities, at least in an operational sense. He always comes out by this gate here. This street, as you can see, is a dead end. He has to go straight west or turn north coming out, but he has done both. This means the only sure spot is here at the corner. There isn't much pedestrian traffic here, oddly enough. One man can probably get by. Two or more, That's a white area. A black man would be conspicuous. Your guy has to wing this one alone, pal. Probably inside this door is the best place to wait. But he'll have to be on his toes or the target will get away.
How does he get out?
I can park a car around this corner or this one. Timing for that is not a concern. We can wait all day for the right slot. And we have a choice of escape routes. Getaway is easy. The problem is your man. He's going to be exposed. If you want my opinion, you should split the operation. Do it one part at a time. No. Miller was adamant. He thought it over for a moment, then he smiled.
We'll do it the way I want. I have just the right man for it. How about the other part?
Alex switched maps. Easy. The target can take any route at all, but they all come to this place at exactly 4:45. We've checked 6 days in the past 2 weeks. Never been off by more than 5 minutes. We'll do the job right along here, close to the bridge. Anybody can handle this one. We can even rehearse it for you.
When?
Sean was eager to get on with it. Alex smiled. This afternoon, good enough?
Excellent.
Miller was well pleased. If it looked good, he'd summon the team, and they'd go in. 4 days, he judged. The weapons were already in place. Carolyn Muller Ryan, M.D., F.A.C.S., lived a very controlled and structured life. She liked it that way. In surgery, she always worked with the same team of doctors, nurses, and technicians. Most surgeons had their peculiarities, and the ophthalmic specialists were unusually fastidious. These traits carried over to her personal life as well. She drove her Porsche with mechanistic precision, always shifting the gears at exactly the right RPM, taking corners on a line as regular as a Formula One driver's. Doing things the same way every time wasn't a rut for Kathy Ryan. It was perfection, which was why she was annoyed with life at the moment. It was a minor annoyance having to take a slightly different route to work every day. In fact, it was something of a challenge, since she gave herself the goal of not letting it affect her schedule. And there weren't many driving problems that a Porsche 911 couldn't handle. Her route this day was down State Route 3, then across a secondary road. That had brought her out onto the Ritchie Highway, 6 miles above the Giant Steps Nursery School. She wondered what she would do when her second child arrived. That, she sighed, would be a problem. Maybe she could finally convince Jack to get a nanny. Her husband was a little too working class in that respect. Getting the maid had already been a great concession. Yes, she thought, we'll get a nanny. After all, Jack's a knight now. She turned right into the Giant Steps parking lot at exactly 4:45, right on schedule.
Mommy!
Sally met her at the door. So what did my big girl do today? Sally liked being called a big girl, and this was Kathy's subterfuge for ensuring that sibling rivalry would be minimized upon the arrival of a little boy or girl. Sally held up a finger painting done on what looked like wide carriage computer paper. It was a credible abstract work of purple and orange. Coat, lunchbox. It took a total of 5 minutes from the time she stopped the car until she was back out the door walking towards it again. She didn't really mind the routineness of her daily schedule. She opened the car door, got Sally into her seat, and made sure the seatbelt was fastened securely before closing and locking the door and going around to the left side of the car. She looked up briefly. There was a blue van parked at the 7-Eleven again. She noticed it twice the previous week. Kathy shrugged it off. 7-Eleven was a convenience store, and lots of people made it a regular stop on the way home.
Hello, Lady Ryan.
Sean Miller checked his watch. 4:52. Next to him, in the back of the van, a man with a camera was shooting away. Alex was inside the store getting a six-pack of Cokes. Miller raised his binoculars. The green Porsche would be easy to spot. Plus, it had a customized license plate. CR-SRGN. Sean wondered who would be using that code next year. Alex got back into the van.
She takes this road south to Route 50, across the Severn River Bridge, then off 50 onto Route 2.
If we hit her before she does that, there'll be no problem getting the job done. Miller agreed.
Excellent. Good work, Alex.
Kathy Ryan walked into her house 15 minutes later. Mother and daughter proceeded to the kitchen, where they heard the unmistakable noise of a husband trying to fix dinner and a television tuned to the McNeil-Lehrer report.
Joining us from our affiliate WGBH in Boston is Patrick, did I pronounce that right, O'Neill, a spokesman for Sinn Féin and an elected member of the British Parliament. Mr. O'Neill, why are you visiting America at this time?
I and many of my colleagues have visited America many times to inform the American people of the oppression inflicted on the Irish people by the British government, the systematic denial of economic opportunity and basic civil rights, the total abrogation of the judicial system, and the continuing brutality of the British Army of Occupation against the people of Ireland.
Mr. O'Neill, some analysts have said that support for your organization in this country has fallen off sharply since the cowardly attack on the royal family in London last year, and that the purpose of your trip is to persuade Irish Americans that the IRA had no part in that. How do you respond to that?
The Irishman smiled at the camera as benignly as Bob Keeshan's Captain Kangaroo.
Data analysis, unfortunately, skirts over legitimate political issues here. Are Northern Ireland's Catholics denied economic and political opportunity? Yes, they are. Have the legal processes in Northern Ireland been subverted for political reasons by the British government? Yes, they have. If I am a terrorist, why am I being allowed into your country? I am, in fact, a member of the British Parliament, elected by the people of my parliamentary district. But you didn't take your seat in Parliament and join the government that is killing my constituents?
Ryan turned the TV off. Jesus, what a mess. He had finished reading everything the CIA had on O'Donnell and the Ulster Liberation Army and had written a brief report. His conclusion was that there was nothing to worry about. Sure, they were a scary bunch, and he certainly hadn't forgotten the look in Sean Miller's eyes. But he didn't think the ULA was about to mount an operation 3,000 miles from home for revenge. He didn't want that conviction to be shaken now. Kathy was relieved. Jack wasn't going to carry the Browning anymore, although he would continue his practice sessions at the academy. He agreed to unload the shotgun. It wasn't that important. He decided to keep the box of shells right next to the gun, on the top shelf of the closet. Sally couldn't reach it. Even Kathy had to stretch.
Ryan is a clever lad, isn't he?
Owens handed the document back to Murray.
Nothing's really new here, but at least it's well organized. Here's the other thing you wanted.
The chief of C-13 took the folder.
Oh, our friends in Boston. How is Patty O'Neill doing?
Owens was more than just annoyed at this. Patrick O'Neill was an insult to the British parliamentary system, an elected mouthpiece for the provisional IRA. In 10 years of trying, however, neither Owen's anti-terror branch nor the Royal Ulster Constabulary had ever linked him to an illegal act.
Drinking a lot of beer, talking to a lot of folks, and raising a little money, just like always.
Murray sipped at his port.
We have agents following him around. He knows they're there, of course. If he spits on the sidewalk, we'll put him on the next bird home. He knows that, too. He hasn't broken a single law. Even his driver, the guy's a teetotaler. I hate to say it, Jimmy, but the bum's clean, and he's making points.
Yes, he's a charming one, Patty is.
Owens flipped a page and looked up.
Let me see that thing your Ryan fellow did again.
Owens flipped to the summary at the back of the report.
Here it is. Good God above.
What? Murray snapped forward in his chair.
The link! The bloody link! It's right here!
What are you talking about? I've read that thing twice myself.
The fact that ULA personnel seem to have been drawn almost entirely from extreme elements within the PIRA itself may have a significance beyond that established by existing evidence. It seems likely that some ULA defectors in place remain within the PIRA, serving as information sources, the information provided being operational in nature, as well as having value as counterintelligence. Operational. We've always assumed that O'Donnell was simply trying to protect himself, but he could be playing another game entirely.
Murray set his glass down and frowned a moment.
I still haven't caught up with you, Jimmy.
Dan, if you wanted to embarrass the Provisionals' leadership politically, how and where would you do it?
Hello, this is Dr. Ryan.
This is Bert Wilson at Johns Hopkins. Your wife asked me to tell you she's in an emergency procedure and she'll be about a half an hour late tonight.
Okay, thank you. Jack replaced the phone. Mondays, he told himself. He went back to discussing the term paper projects with his two mids. His desk clock said 4 p.m. Well, there was no hurry, was there? Across the campus, the watch changed. The civilian guard at Gate 3 was named Bob Riggs, retired Navy Chief Master at Arms past 50, with a beer belly that made it hard for him to see his shoes. The cold affected him badly, and he spent most of his time inside the guardhouse. He didn't see a man in his late 30s approach the opposite corner and disappear into a doorway. Neither did Sergeant Tom Cummings of the Marine Guard Force, who was checking some paperwork just after relieving the previous watchstander. The academy was good duty for the young Marine NCO, and it had been a typical Monday. He was already yawning. 50 feet away, an elderly woman approached the entrance to the apartment building. She was surprised to see a handsome young man there and dropped her shopping bag while fumbling for her key.
Can I help you with that now?
His accent made him sound different, but rather kind, the lady thought. He picked up her bag while she unlocked the door. Smiling, he handed it to her, and she disappeared inside. His hand relaxed around the knife in his pocket. Sergeant Cummings finished going over the papers and walked outside. He noticed the man in the doorway for the first time. Looked like he was waiting for someone, the sergeant judged, and trying to keep out of the cold north wind. That seemed sensible enough. The sergeant checked his watch. 4:15.
The target is moving.
The message was relayed by radio from the roof of the parking garage at Johns Hopkins Hospital to an apartment near the Lexington Market, and from there by telephone to Alex's safe house, then by radio again.
About bloody time. Why the hell is she late?
The last hour had been infuriating for Sean Miller. First 30 minutes of waiting for her to be on time, then another 30 minutes while she wasn't. He told himself to relax. She had to be at the daycare center to pick up the kid.
She's a doc. It happens, man. Let's roll.
Alex started the van. The pickup car let off. They would be at the 7-Eleven across from Giant Steps in exactly 30 minutes. Bob Riggs stepped back into the guardhouse at Gate 3.
He's still there.
Cummings was surprised.
He must be waiting for somebody pretty.
3 weeks before, Master Sergeant Breckinridge had briefed the guard force about the possible threat to Dr. Ryan. Cummings knew that the history teacher always went out this gate. He was late today, though. Though the duty here was easy, Cummings was serious about it. 3 months in Beirut had taught him everything he needed to know about that. He walked outside and took a place on the other side of the road. He never stared at the apartment building, never acted as though he knew anybody was there. It was getting dark now, and it wasn't all that easy to see him anyway, but somebody was there.
That was fast.
The man in the pickup car checked his watch. She'd just knocked 5 minutes off her fastest time. Damn, he thought. It must be nice to have one of those little Porsches. He checked the tags, CR-SRGN. Yep, that was the one. He grabbed the radio.
Hi, Mom, I'm home.
It's about time.
The van was half a mile away, sitting on Joyce Lane, west of Ritchie Highway. He saw the lady come out of the daycare center less than 2 minutes later. She was in a hurry.
Rolling.
Okay.
Kathy Ryan hated to be late. She hadn't been this late in over a month. But she could still make it home before Jack, if she hustled.
Come on, Sally, buckle up.
The rush hour was underway in earnest, but the Porsche was small, fast, and agile. In a minute from sitting in the parking lot, she was doing 65, weaving through traffic like a race driver at Daytona. For all their preparation, Alex almost missed her. An 18-wheeler was laboring up the hill in the right lane when the distinctive shape of the Porsche appeared next to it. Alex floored the van and darted onto the road, causing the semi to jam his brakes and horn at the same time. Alex didn't look back. Miller got out of the right front seat and went back to the window on the sliding door.
Can you catch her?
Alex just smiled.
Damn, look at that Porsche.
Trooper First Class Sam Waverly was driving J-30, a state police car, coming off an afternoon of pursuit radar work on U.S. Route 50. He and Larry Fontana in J-19 were heading back to the Annapolis Police Barracks off Roe Boulevard after a long day's work when they saw the green sports car take the entrance ramp off Ritchie Highway. Both troopers were driving about 65 miles per hour, a privilege that accrued only to police officers. Their cars were unmarked. This made them and their radar guns impossible to spot until it was too late. They usually worked in pairs and took turns, with one working his radar gun and the other a quarter of a mile down the road to wave the speeders over for their tickets.
There's another one. Let's get him.
Waverly and Fontana were both young officers, and while contrary to legend that state police didn't assign ticket quotas to its officers, everyone knew that one sure way to promotion was to ride a lot of them. It also made the road safer, and that was their mission as state troopers. Waverly picked up the microphone in J-30. I got the Porsche.
You get all the fun.
Fontana had gotten a fast look at the driver. Neither officer really enjoyed giving out traffic citations, but they enjoyed responding to major traffic accidents far less. Kathy checked her clock again. She'd managed to cut nearly 10 minutes off her trip time. Next, she checked her rearview mirror for a police car. She didn't want to get a ticket. There was nothing that looked like a cop car, only ordinary cars and trucks. She had to slow down as the traffic became congested approaching the Severn River Bridge. Beside her, Sally was craning her neck to see over the dash as usual and playing with the seatbelt buckle. Kathy didn't say anything this time, but concentrated on the traffic as she eased off the pedal. In the van, Miller slipped the door latch and moved the door an inch backwards. Another man took hold of the door as Miller knelt and thumbed the safety forward on his weapon. 50 yards back, Trooper Waverly scowled. He couldn't get the Porsche for speeding now. It had slowed before he could establish the speed. Fontana could, however, ticket the van for improper lane changing, and 1 out of 2 wasn't bad. Waverly checked his mirror. J-19 was catching up. He looked at the road ahead. There was something odd about the black van, like the side door wasn't quite closed.
Now!
Alex moved the van into position on the left side of the green Porsche. Kathy noticed it coming up and took a casual look in time to see the van's side door slide back. There was a man kneeling, holding something. Then came a chilling moment of realization. She stomped her foot on the brake a fraction of a second before she saw the white flash. Waverly saw a foot-long tongue of flame spit out from the side of the van. The windshield of the Porsche went cloudy, and the car swerved sideways, straightening out, then slamming into the bridge's concrete work at over 50 miles per hour. Instantly, cars in both lanes slammed on their brakes. The van kept going.
Larry, shots fired! Shots fired from the van! The Porsche was hit!
Waverly flipped on his lights and stood on the brakes. The police car skidded right and nearly slid sideways into the wrecked Porsche.
Get the van! Get the van!
I'm on him. Holy shit!
Fontana realized that the tongue of flame he'd seen could only mean some kind of machine gun.
Did you get her?
Alex called to the man in the back of the van. Miller was breathing heavily. He wasn't sure about his shots. The Porsche had slowed suddenly just as he squeezed the trigger, but he saw the car hit the bridge and spring up into the air like a toy. No way they could walk away from that sort of accident, he was sure of that.
Yes! Okay, then, let's boogie!
Alex didn't let his emotions interfere with his work. This job meant weapons and money for his movement. It was too bad about the woman and the kid, but it wasn't his fault they had the wrong kind of enemies. The Annapolis dispatcher was already on his UHF radio to the state police helicopter. Trooper 1, a Bell Jet Ranger 2, was just lifting off from a refueling stop at Baltimore, Washington International Airport.
Trooper 1 to J-30, Trooper 1 to J-30. We are en route to your 1020. ETA 4 minutes, over.
Waverly didn't acknowledge. He and two civilians were prying the driver's side window off the car with a tire iron. The driver and passenger were both unconscious, and there was blood all over the interior of the car. She was probably pretty, Waverly thought, looking at the driver, but her head was covered with glistening blood. The child lay like a broken doll, half on the seat, half on the floor. His stomach was a tight, cold ball just below his pounding heart. Another dead kid, he thought. Please, God, not another one. A second police helicopter, Trooper 2, was just over Mayo Beach on its way back to Annapolis with the state governor and the attorney general aboard when the order came through to contact and support car J-19 immediate. The dispatcher already had six state vehicles converging on the accident scene, plus three more from Anne Arundel County Police Station at Edgewater. The sergeant flying Trooper 2 could see the other helicopter circling over the accident to the east, and Route 50 was nearly bare of cars from the west of the Severn River Bridge to Roe Boulevard. The black van and the police car were on the back edge of the moving traffic. The governor leaned forward from the back of the chopper.
"What gives?"
The paramedic in the left front seat filled them in as the pilot dropped altitude to 500 feet.
"Trooper 2 to J-19, Trooper 2 to J-19, we're on top of you."
"Subject vehicle handicap tag, Marilyn Henry, 6772. J-30 and I observed automatic weapons fire from this vehicle. Repeat automatic weapons fire. I need some help, people."
Alex was wondering who the car was. It was unmarked, but a cheap body car with dull monocolor paintwork.
"Uh-oh, that's a cop behind us."
One of Miller's men looked out the window. Unmarked cars were nothing new where he came from. Alex snarled,
"Get rid of him."
Fontana was holding at 50 yards from the van. This was far enough, he thought, to keep himself out of danger. He was a second late on seeing the van's rear door fly open. Fontana blanched and hit the brakes. He felt the bullet hit his chest just before he realized the car's windshield was shattering around him. His right arm jerked down, turning the car too rapidly to the right. The locked rear wheels gave the car a broadside skid. A tire blew out, and the car flipped over. Fontana watched in fascination the world rotate around him as the car's top crumbled. Like most police officers, he never bothered with his seatbelt, and he fell on his neck. The collapsing car top broke it.
"Shit!"
The pilot of Trooper 2 had seen it all.
"Trooper 2 to Annapolis. J-19 is wrecked with Sirius PI on 50 west of Route 2 exit. Where the hell are the other cars?"
"Trooper 2, be advised there is a roadblock ahead of you on 50 and cars approaching you in both directions."
"Roger that. I'm on the van."
Inside the van, Sean Miller was busy stuffing his weapon into a canvas bag.
"Come on, Alex."
The black man at the wheel was calm.
"We're almost there, man."
He changed lanes to the right lane exit. About a mile ahead, he saw the blue and red flashing lights of two police cars coming east towards him. But there was no eastbound exit here.
"Tough luck, pigs. Here we go."
Alex hit the traffic light at the bottom of the exit ramp exactly right, crossed West Street and headed north. His peripheral vision caught a county police car stuck in the rush hour traffic on West Street, 200 yards to his right, despite his lights and siren.
"Too late, pigs."
The van proceeded 200 yards and turned into the parking lot of Annapolis Mall. Alex pulled into a handicapped parking slot and stopped the van. His passengers were ready and opened the door as soon as the vehicle stopped. They walked slowly and normally to the entrance to the mall. The driver looked up in surprise when he heard the whine and flutter of the helicopter. It hovered about 100 feet. Alex made sure his hat was in place and waved as he went through the door. Clutching the receiver to his ear inside the guardhouse, the young Marine waited for Sergeant Major Breckinridge to come on the line.
"Hello?"
"Gunny, this is Cummings at Gate 3. There's a guy standing on the corner across the street. Been there about 45 minutes. He's off the grounds, but it just doesn't feel right, you know?"
"Okay, stay put. I'll walk on up."
Sergeant Major Breckinridge donned his cap and stepped out of his office at the Lejeune Annex and headed north across campus. He didn't like the cold, but no one was scheduled to use the firing range at this hour anyway, and he was bored. It took 5 minutes, during which time he saluted six officers and greeted a large number of mids. He found Cummings in the guardhouse, standing inside the door. A good young sergeant, Cummings was. He had that new look of the Corps. Breckinridge was built along John Wayne lines with broad shoulders and imposing bulk. Cummings was a black kid, a runner who had the frame of a Frank Shorter. The boy could run all day, something that the gunny had never been able to do. The sergeant major knew he would soon be part of the Corps' past. Cummings was its future, and he told himself that future looked pretty good.
"Hey, gunny."
"That guy in the doorway?"
"Over there. He's been there since a little after 4. He doesn't live there."
Cummings paused for a moment. He was, after all, only a buck sergeant, with no rockers under his stripes, talking to a man whom generals addressed with respect.
"It just feels funny."
Breckinridge frowned.
"Well, let's give him a few minutes."
"Ryan here."
Seated in his office across campus, Jack Ryan had just finished an afternoon of grading papers when the call came from the state police.
"Yeah, that's right."
Robbie Jackson saw his friend go stiff in the chair as he listened to what the caller had to say. He saw Ryan's face change, and he heard his voice become guarded.
Where are they now?
He looked across at Robbie, his eyes filled with pain.
Okay, yeah, thank you.
Jack stared at the phone for a second or two before hanging it up.
What's the matter, Jack?
It took him a moment to answer. That was the police. There's been an accident. Robbie was on his feet in an instant. Jack stood shakily.
They flew them. They flew them to Baltimore, the university hospital. I have to get there. God, Robbie.
Robbie got his coat and tossed Jack's over the desk. Ryan put it on and Robbie grabbed his arm.
Come on, boy. I'll drive you.
The flyer led his friend down the steps out of the building. His red Corvette was parked 100 yards away. Less than a minute later, the civilian guard at gate number 3 waved Jackson through before stepping back into the guardhouse.
Still there?
Breckenridge nodded.
Okay, this is what we're going to do.
Ned Clark hadn't liked the mission from the first moment. Sean was too eager on this one, but he hadn't said so. Sean had masterminded the prison break that had made him a free man. If nothing else, Ned was loyal to the cause. He was exposed here and didn't like that either. His briefing had told him the guards at the academy gate were lax, and he could see that they were unarmed. They had no authority off the grounds of the school. Ought to call this one off, Clark told himself. But he didn't want to do that. He didn't want to fail Sean. He saw a pair of men leave the academy, bootnecks, bloody Marines in their Sunday clothes. They looked so pretty without their guns, so vulnerable. They were joking and laughing to themselves.
How about a couple of beers?
The big one was in the lead. He stepped back into the street. The other man followed.
Okay by me, Gunny. You buying? My turn, isn't it? I have to get some money first.
They were directly in front of the doorway now. Suddenly the big one turned towards Clark.
Excuse me, sir. Can I help you?
Clark reacted quickly, but not quickly enough. The right hand inside his coat pocket started moving up, but Breckenridge's own right grabbed it like a vice.
I asked you if I could help you, sir. What do you have in that hand?
Clark tried to move, but the big man pushed him back up against the brick wall.
Careful, Tom.
Cummings' hand stretched downwards and found the metallic shape of a pistol.
Gun!
The gunny shoved his left arm across Clark's throat.
It had better not go off. Let the man have it, sonny, real careful-like.
Clark was amazed at his stupidity, letting them get so close to him. His head tried to turn to look up the street, but the man waiting for him in the car was around the corner. Before he could think of anything to do, the black man had disarmed him and was searching his pockets. Cummings removed the knife next. Breckenridge smiled.
Talk to me.
At first, Clark said nothing at all. The forearm slid roughly across his throat.
Please talk to me, sir. Get your bloody hands off me. Who do you think you are?
The sergeant major wrenched Clark's arm out of the pocket and twisted it up behind his back.
Where are you from, boy?
Breckenridge didn't need an answer to that one. He gave Clark a slight push.
Okay, sonny. We're going to walk through that gate yonder, and you're going to sit down and be a good boy while we call the police. If you make any trouble, I'm going to tear this arm off and shove it right up your ass. Let's go, boy.
The driver who'd been waiting for Clark was standing at the far corner. He took one look at what had happened and walked to his car. 2 minutes later, he was blocks away. Cummings handcuffed Clark to a chair while Breckenridge established that he had no identification aside from an automatic pistol, which was ID enough. First he called his captain, then the Annapolis City Police. It started there, but though the gunny didn't know it, it wouldn't stop there. If Jack had ever doubted that Robbie Jackson was a fighter pilot, the ride to the Shock Trauma Center of the Maryland Institute for Emergency Medical Services through the late rush hour traffic would have cured him of it forever. Kathy had worked there for a while during her residency, an intense 2 months that she'd been happy to leave behind. Sitting in the waiting room, Jack wondered if she were being treated by a former colleague. Would he recognize her? Would it matter? After 4 hours, Jackson quietly left the waiting room to call his wife. It had started to rain outside, a cold rain that perfectly matched what Ryan felt.
Mr. Ryan?
It was a doctor. Probably a doctor. He wore a pink paper gown and strange-looking pink booties over what were probably sneakers. The gown was blood-stained. He couldn't be much over 30, Ryan judged. Dr. Barry Shapiro, the name tag announced, Deputy Trauma Surgeon in Chief. What news do you bring me, Ryan thought. His mind both screamed for information and dreaded learning what had happened to his family. He tried to stand, but found he could not. The surgeon sat down on the chair next to the sofa.
Okay, your wife is fine. She has a broken and lacerated upper left arm and a nasty cut on her head, a mild concussion, but nothing to worry about. She'll be fine.
Ryan nodded, afraid to ask the next question. She's pregnant. Do you? Dr. Shapiro smiled. We noticed. No problem with that. The pregnancy has not been compromised in any way.
She's a surgeon. Will there be any permanent damage?
Shapiro looked surprised. Oh, I didn't know that. We don't bother much with patient identification. There shouldn't be any problem. The damage to her arm is extensive but routine. It should heal completely. The surgeon paused before going on. Does the bad news come next? Ryan wondered.
Your daughter is a very sick little girl. Jack nearly choked with his next breath.
The iron fist that had clutched his stomach relaxed a millimeter. Sally's alive, he thought. At least she's alive.
Apparently she wasn't wearing her seatbelt. When the car hit, she was thrown forward very hard.
Jack nodded. Sally liked to play with her seatbelt buckle. We thought it was cute, Ryan reminded himself bitterly.
Okay, tib and fib are broken in both legs, along with the left femur. All of the left side ribs are broken, and six on the right side. A classic flailed chest.
Robbie returned from making his call and listened without interrupting while Shapiro finished the briefing. Ryan would have to wait at least 8 hours more before seeing his wife. He wasn't sure in the case of the child, but it wouldn't be any sooner than that. 8 more hours? Ryan had no choice. He would wait right there. He leaned his head back against the wall and closed his eyes. Shapiro left, and Jackson followed him out, catching him by the elevator.
Doc, can't Jack see his little girl?
Shapiro half fell against the wall and let out a long breath.
Look, right now she's in bed with IV tubes running into her and her head partially shaved. She's wired up to a half dozen monitors and... Look, she might die. I don't think so, but if she does, would you want your friend to remember her like that for the rest of his life?
Robbie hesitated, then shook his head. Shapiro continued.
The wife's a different story. Shows you what a difference a seatbelt can make. It won't protect you against a 9mm jacketed slug, but...
Robbie's hand clamped shut on the doctor's arm as the elevator arrived.
Jacketed slug? Did you tell him that?
Shapiro appeared pensive.
You know, I'm not sure I did. God, I must be tireder than I thought.
Inside the elevator, Barry Shapiro checked his watch. It was 5 in the morning.
No wonder I feel so tired, he thought. 20 hours on duty. I'm too old for this.
He was senior staff. He was supposed to know better. He rode the elevator to the top floor, followed the hall along to the fire stairs, then climbed slowly up the 6 flights to the roof.
God, he thought, dear God, I am tired.
The roof was flat, covered with tar and gravel, spotted here and there with the UHF antenna for the hospital's SISCOM communications net, and a few air conditioning condensers. Shapiro lit a cigarette in the lee of the stairway tower, cursing himself for his inability to break the nauseous habit. He walked to the edge of the roof, rested his foot on the parapet as though on a bar rail, and blew smoke into the early morning air. The night's rain had washed the sky clean of its normal pollution, and he could see stars overhead in the pre-dawn darkness. Below him, the city of Baltimore was quiet, its houses dark, its streets empty. He had been surprised to learn that the 19th century writer Edgar Allan Poe had died in Baltimore after falling asleep drunk in the gutter, and that Poe's home was only blocks from the University Hospital complex, a demi-shrine for the local literati. Barry Shapiro loathed Poe. It seemed to the surgeon that everything about the writer was dark and twisted, always expecting the inevitability of death, violent, untimely death, Shapiro's own very personal enemy. He had come to think of Poe as the embodiment of that enemy, sometimes beaten, sometimes not.
You son of a bitch, Shapiro whispered to himself, to Poe, to no one. You son of a bitch, not this time. You don't get this one. This one goes home.
He flicked the cigarette away and watched the point of orange light fall all the way to the shining empty street. He turned back to the stairs. It was time to get some sleep. The photograph of Iman Clark was already at the embassy when Dan Murray arrived. He had just gotten to sleep when the call came through from Bill Shaw at the FBI in Washington. The Maryland State Police were holding a man on a range of weapons and immigration charges pending further advice. They thought he had an Irish accent. His mugshot was being faxed to the U.S. Embassy for identification as they spoke. Murray got dressed and headed downstairs for his car. It was easier for Owens. His house was always watched by a pair of armed detectives in a police car. All he had to do was step outside and wave, and the Land Rover came to his door. He beat Murray to Grosvenor Square by 5 minutes. By the time the FBI agent had arrived, Owens had already consumed a cup of tea. He poured two more. Murray found the photograph in his box. He looked at it and tossed it over. "This guy look familiar?" Owens' eyes went wide. "Ned Clark? In America, you say?" Dan Murray nodded sleepily. "I thought he looked familiar. He got picked up in Annapolis." The chief of C-13 studied the face with interest. "This is one of the lads who broke out of Long Kesh. A very bad boy with several murders to his name. Thank you, Mr. Murray." "Thank the Marines. Again." Murray picked up the telephone and dialed, and simultaneously began draining the cup of tea. He really needed the caffeine. Within moments, he was back to FBI headquarters. His desk phone was on a speaker so that Owens could listen in.
"Bill Shaw speaking."
"Bill, Dan Murray here. The suspect is one Ned Clark, a convicted murderer who escaped from prison last year. He's a Provo assassin."
"I got some bad news, Dan. It appears there was an attack on this fellow Ryan's family. The state police are investigating what looks like a machine gun attack on a car belonging to Dr. Carolyn Ryan, M.D. The suspects were in a van and made a clean escape after killing a state trooper."
"Where is Jack Ryan?"
"We don't know yet. He was seen leaving the academy grounds with a friend. As soon as we find him, we'll put some people with him. On this Clark kid, I expect that Mr. Owens wants him back."
Owens leaned forward in his chair.
"Yes, thank you."
He had his own call to make now. As often happens in police work, there was bad news to accompany the good. Jack had been awake for more than 24 hours when he finally got in to see Kathy. Robbie had told him what the doctor had said about the bullet, and then the whole world had found him, and he had to pull himself together. First came a charge d'affaires from the British Embassy bearing an urgent cable from Her Majesty. The message was brief, kind, and to the point. Then came the state police. He didn't have much to tell them, of course, but he was interested to hear what they knew about the matter. He knew now that this had been no mere accident, that it was a consequence of something he had done, something stupid. It was his fault and his alone. The doorknob was cold, accusing metal in his hand as he entered the room. Kathy was lying in her single bedroom. Her arm was in a cast. An enormous purple bruise covered the right side of her face, and there was a bandage over half her forehead. Her face turned towards his. Her eyes were blackened and full of tears.
"I'm sorry, Jack."
"My God," he thought. "She thinks it's her fault. What do I say now?"
"I knew she was fooling with the seatbelt, but I didn't do anything because I was in a hurry. And then the truck came, and I didn't have time to... If I had made sure she was strapped in, Sally would be fine. But I was in a hurry."
She looked away.
"Oh, Jack, I'm so sorry."
He was stunned at what he'd just heard. He held Kathy's hand to his face and kissed it.
"She's going to be okay, babe, and so are you. That's the only thing that matters now."
She looked at the wall.
"But..."
"No buts." Her face turned back. Kathy tried to smile, but tears were rolling from her eyes. Ryan held her hand tighter. "I talked to Dr. Ellenstone at Hopkins. He came over and saw Sally. He says she'll be okay. He says that Shapiro saved her life." Her hand closed on his like a claw. He leaned forward to kiss her, but before their lips touched, both started weeping.
"It's okay, Kathy."
Jack was starting to believe that it really was, or at least that it would be so again. His world had not ended, not quite. But someone else's will, he told himself. The thought was a quiet, distant one, voiced in a part of his mind that was already looking at the future, while the present occupied his sight. Seeing his wife weeping tears caused by someone else started a cold rage in him which only someone else's death could ever warm.
"It had wheelchair tags, but the dude who drove it didn't look crippled or anything."
"You remember what he looked like?"
Yeah, he was about as black as me. Tall dude. He wore sunglasses, the mirror kind. He had a beard, too. There was always at least one other dude in the truck, but I never got a look at him.
The van had been identified for more than a day off the FBI's computer. It had been stolen a month before in New York City, repainted, and given new tags. The set found on it had been stolen from a nursing home's van in Hagerstown, Maryland, 100 miles away. They had the shooter ID'd. Kathy Ryan thought she had recognized Sean Miller's face. If it was Miller, he had a beard now, on the brown side of black and neatly trimmed. An artist would try to recreate that. The ammunition used was Belgium-made, from the Fabrique Nationale at Liège. They might be able to identify the lot numbers, but the FN made so many millions such rounds per year, which were shipped and reshipped all over the world, that the lead was a slim one.
He always bought a six-pack of Coke Classic. Once or twice he got some Twinkies, but he always got himself the Cokes.
What did he sound like? Anything special?
Nah, just a dude, you know.
Would you mind looking through some pictures?
Gotta clear it with the boss. I mean, I need the job, but you say this guy tried to kill a little girl? Yeah, sure, I'll help you.
The identification of Miller's accomplices wasn't going so well. The FBI knew of no local black groups having contacts with the ULA. The clerk at the 7-Eleven spent several hours going over pictures of blacks thought to be members of revolutionary groups and came up with three possibilities. Two of the three were in prison. The third had dropped out of sight 7 years before. He was only a picture to the Bureau. Constantine Dupins, his alias had been. Well-spoken on the few occasions when he'd spoken at all. Educated, probably. Attached to a group which the Bureau had been watching, but was never really a part of it, the file went on. He had never participated in an illegal act and had drifted away when the leaders of the group had started talking about supporting themselves with bank robberies and drug trafficking. Maybe a dilettante, Bill Shaw thought. He returned to the photo of Constantine Dupins one more time. Not much to go on, Shaw told himself to be patient. Despite 22 years in the FBI, patience was still something he had to force on himself.
I was starting to like the beard.
Damn thing itched too much.
Alexander Constantine Dubbins was back at his job.
I was spending all my time just scratching my face.
Yeah, same thing when I was on subs. It's different when you're young.
Speak for yourself, you old married turkey.
You ought to settle down, Alex.
The world is full of interesting things to do, and I haven't done them all yet.
Not hardly, thought Alex. He was field engineer for Baltimore Gas and Electric Company and usually worked nights. The job forced him to spend much of his time on the road checking equipment and supervising line crews. Alex was a popular fellow who didn't mind getting his hands dirty, who actually enjoyed the physical work that many engineers were too proud to do. A man of the people, he called himself. He was still amazed that the woman and kid had survived. Testimony, his training told him, to the efficiency of seatbelts, not to mention the work of the Porsche engineers. Killing a little kid and a pregnant woman wasn't exactly something to brag about. They had wasted a state trooper, and that was enough for him. Losing that Clark boy to the cops continued to wrangle Dobbins, though. I told that dumb fuck that the man was too exposed there, he told himself. But no, Sean wanted to waste the whole family at once. Damn political science majors. They think they can make something happen if you wish hard enough. Engineers knew different. Dobbins took comfort in the fact that all the suspects mentioned in the media were white. Waving at the helicopter had been his mistake. Bravado had no place in revolutionary activity. It was his own lesson to be learned, but this mistake hadn't hurt anyone. The gloves and hat had denied the pigs a description. The really funny thing was that the operation had been a success. The IRA punk, Patty O'Something, had been booted out of Boston with his honky tail between his legs. At least the operation had been politically sound, and that, Alex told himself, was the real measure of success. Within a week after the attack, Ryan was back in his little cubbyhole office at Langley. He was not admitted to the meetings between CIA and FBI people coordinating information on the case. Marty Kanner had explained to him that the FBI might be uneasy to have him there. Jack didn't mind. He'd get the information summaries after lunch, and that was enough for the moment. He wanted to pursue his own lines of inquiry. It was the military training the ULA had received which struck him in his early research, and he chose to start there. He was going over satellite reconnaissance data at the moment. The bound report he was looking at contained no less than 16 maps.
In addition to the cities and roads on them were little red triangles designating suspected terrorist camps in four countries. They did have a report from an Italian agent who had once seen Sean Miller leaving a freighter in Benghazi Harbor, so Ryan concentrated on the camps in Libya. The pictures in the heavy binder that occupied his attention were of camps 11-5-4, 11-5-18, and 11-5-20. Jack didn't know how the number designators had been arrived at and really didn't care. The camps were all pretty much the same. Only the spacing of the huts distinguished one from the other. One, taken a week after Miller had been seen in Benghazi, showed a car, it looked like a Toyota Land Cruiser, about a mile from 11-5-18 heading away. Ryan wondered where it was going. He wrote down the date and time on the bottom of the photograph and checked the cross-reference table in the front. 10 minutes later, he found the same car the next day at Camp 11-5-9, a PIRA camp 40 miles from 11-5-18. Jack told himself not to get overly excited. 11-5-18 could belong to the West German Red Army faction, Italy's insurgent Red Brigade, or any number of other organizations with which the PIRA cross-pollinated. He still made some notes. It was a datum, a bit of information that was worth checking out. Next, he checked the occupancy graph for the camp. This showed the number of camp buildings occupied at night and went back over 2 years. Strangely, the clarity of the photos was better at night. The cooler night air was less roiled and did not interfere with imaging as much as in the simmering heat of the day. Infrared photography also allowed one to determine the number of heaters in use in each building at night, another sign of occupancy. CIA had strict rules on the use of copying machines, so he ended up memorizing several of the graphs, comparing their data with a list of known ULA operations. There was some sort of pattern, he thought, but what kind of pattern? Every 3 months, mostly the occupancy rate picks up. After a few weeks of this, Jack unfolded his own graph. Marty Cantor frowned at it for a moment, then he flipped through the photographs.
You might have something, Jack. Periodic weapons refresher, maybe? It would fit their profile.
The CIA man paused.
The guys we have on this stuff are technicians, not analysts. Camp 18 looks interesting enough that we might try to figure a way to check it out, see who really lives there.
Not bad.
He's violated security. Kevin O'Donnell spoke softly, though no one in the noisy pub could have heard him. There was to be no contact for 3 months.
The ULA chief eyed the bookish gentleman sitting opposite him. Dennis Cooley, he was sure of, but the Englishman, his contact, could not be trusted. Cooley slid the envelope across the table.
Perhaps this is worth it. Instructions?
O'Donnell took the envelope.
When are you going back?
Tomorrow morning, the early flight.
O'Donnell nodded, finishing off his drink. Then he left the pub and walked directly to his car. 20 minutes later, he was home. 10 minutes after that, his operations chief was in his study.
Sean, how do you like working with Alex's organization?
Miller reflected a moment. The operation had been a political success. Public outrage over the attempted assassination of the Ryan family had definitely scuttled Patrick O'Neill's mission on behalf of the PIRA. But it hadn't settled his own score with the bootnick, Sir John Ryan. He tried now not to let his emotions color his assessment.
Alex is a very thorough technician, but an arrogant one. He hasn't a great deal of formal training. He's clever, very clever, and he's hungry, as they say over there. He wants to make his mark.
O'Donnell smiled. He had sensed Miller's disappointment over the outcome of the mission. He was sure that Sean wanted to try again.
Well, your arrogant friend may just have his chance next summer.
The ULA chief paused, holding up the letter Cooley had delivered.
It would seem that His Royal Highness will be visiting America next summer. The Treasure Houses exhibit was such a success that they are gone to stage another one. The show opens in Washington on August the 1st, and the Prince of Wales will be going over to start things off. This will not be announced until July, but here is his itinerary, including the proposed security arrangements. It is yet undecided whether or not his lovely bride will accompany His Highness, but we will proceed on the assumption that she will.
Miller scanned the letter quickly. He looked up.
And the child? I rather suspect not, but we will allow for that possibility also.
We have plenty of time, and we'll use all of it.
After Miller had left, O'Donnell wrote his instructions for their agent in London.
C-13 Anti-Terrorist Branch Chief James Owens had identified 39 people who knew, or might have known, information common to the ambush on the Mall and Miller's transport to the Isle of Wight. One of them had leaked the information. Every one of them was being watched. Each night, the daily surveillance reports came to Scotland Yard, where they were put on computer. Owens viewed the entire operation as necessary, but rather distasteful. No one's life could survive this kind of scrutiny. He told himself that one person's life wouldn't, and that was the point of the exercise.
"I see Mr. Watkins visited a rare bookshop this afternoon."
Owens handed the printout to David Ashley, the Home Office security officer who had been on the case since the attempted ambush 5 months before.
"Ah, yes, he collects them. So do I. I wonder what he bought. Let's see."
Ashley studied the report.
"He was there for 10 minutes, spoke with the proprietor. That would be a Mr. Dennis Cooley, one of the best men in the trade."
The security officer made a mental note to have a look at the shop for himself. Though Owens regarded Ashley as something of a snooty bastard, he respected the young man's intelligence and insight.
"The first new person Watkins has seen in several weeks."
Owens thought about it for a moment. There were better leads than this to follow up on, and his manpower was limited. Ashley visited the bookshop at 4 p.m. A true bibliophile, he stopped on opening the door to appreciate the aroma.
"Is Mr. Cooley in today?"
The clerk looked remarkably like a mouse. Her hair was exactly the proper drab shade of brown and ill-kept. Ashley remembered buying his wife an early Bronte edition here. He had wondered at the time if those two sad, lonely sisters had looked like this girl. Beatrix looked up from her work at the desk.
"No, sir. He's abroad on business."
Ashley looked around at the shelves filled with old volumes and smiled.
"How does he find such things?"
"Mr. Dennis can smell them. He's always traveling, working with other dealers and lawyers and such. He's in Ireland today, for example. It's amazing how many books he manages to obtain over there. Those horrid people have the most marvelous collections." Ashley did not react to this bit of news at all, at least not physically, but a switch in the back of his head flipped on. He continued to talk with the girl for a while, expressed interest in an early Marlowe whose cover was in poor condition, but whose pages were in a remarkable state of preservation, and left. 10 minutes later, he got past the security checkpoint at Scotland Yard and took the elevator to James Owen's office. Jack Ryan's life was slowly returning to normal. Kathy had returned to work at the hospital, and Sally was bouncing back the way any healthy child should. The healing process was well underway. Jack's courses at the academy were all scheduled in the afternoon, which made it possible for him to put in long mornings at Langley. He had given up on the satellite photographs weeks before. Now he was trying to find patterns within the terrorist network. Which group had connections with the other? Where did their arms come from? The problem with these questions was not a lack of information, but a glut of it. Literally thousands of CIA agents, plus those of every other Western intelligence service, were scouring the world for such information in the hope of delivering the one piece of information that would crack open Abu Nidal for a substantial reward. The result was thousands of communiques, most of them worthless garbage that was indistinguishable from the one or two nuggets of real information. The difficulty of finding any single organization was inversely proportional to its size. "This ULA outfit is so goddamn small. I have 16 suspected contacts between the IRA and other groups. Some of them could be our boys, but how can you tell?" Marty Cantor smiled.
"Well, the next time you hear somebody ask what the CIA is doing about terrorism, you won't be able to tell them."
"But the battle is being lost," Jack told himself. "It sure as hell isn't being won." "How's the FBI doing?" The CIA man shook his head. "Nothing new. The black guy, well, he might as well not exist as far as anyone can tell. They have a crummy picture that's several years old, an alias with no real name or prints to check, and about 10 lines of description that mainly says he's smart enough to keep his mouth shut."
Ryan looked down at his desk. His frustration was apparent. Marty Cantor continued.
"The boys at Scotland Yard may have a small break on their security leak, though. They're trying to decide now if it's real or not. That's the good news. The bad news is that His Royal Highness is traveling to America this summer.
A number of people were informed of his itinerary, including six on their possible list of suspects. Can't they get him to call it off? The prince won't do that. He's adamant. He won't allow a terrorist threat to affect his life in any way. Alex Dobbins was helping the lineman from Baltimore Gas and Electric to install an experimental transformer in the Peregrine Cliff power sector outside of Annapolis. Both men were perched at the top of a utility pole at the end of Falcon's Nest Road, about a half a mile from Ryan's house. Alex looked across at his colleague and smiled.
They're home.
Lewis nodded. He owed his job to Alex. He trusted him. Indeed, he respected Alex as one might an older brother. But Lewis had doubts as well. I don't like wasting kids, man. A cop's a different thing. He didn't need to add that so was the kid's father. That was business. Like Alex, he had a few remaining scruples.
Maybe we were all lucky.
Alex raised his camera and snapped off a string of shots. He knew, objectively, that this was a stupid way for a revolutionary to think. Sentimentality had no place in his mission. But he also knew that taboos against injuring children were a part of the genetic programming of any human being. Mankind had progressed in its knowledge since Marx and Lenin, so whenever possible, he'd avoid injuring kids.
So what have you seen?
The cops, state cops, are back here every 2 hours minimum. One of them asked what we were doing yesterday afternoon. There's an extra phone line into the place. Gotta be for an alarm company. Alex made a mental note of the information.
Keep your eyes open, but don't be too obvious.
He is thorough. The ULA commander was going over the aerial photographs that Dobbins had copied, topographic maps, and photos of Ryan's home from the land and water sides. Added to these were typed notes of the observations made by his people and other data thought to be of interest. Sean Miller shrugged coolly.
Unfortunately, he allows his personal feelings to interfere with his activities. And you don't, Sean.
The ULA operations chief showed no emotion in response to his leader's criticism.
It won't happen again.
O'Donnell smiled.
Good. The important thing about mistakes is that we learn from them. So let's go over to your proposed operation.
Sean took out two other maps and began to explain his plan.
We'll need 15 men. I think we can depend on Alex for three, himself included. Now the cliff runs along one side of the house.
The weapon used in the attempt on Ryan's wife turned up about 3 weeks later. It was an Uzi, the 9mm Israeli submachine gun used all over the world because of its quality, balance, and accuracy. The chances were 1,000,000 to 1 that this would happen, really. A Maryland boy had pulled it out of a flooded quarry on the end of his fishing line, heavily corroded but in good enough condition to be fired. So the FBI had been able to link it to the bullet that had killed Officer Fontana with relative ease. The task of finding out where the gun had come from would not be simple. From his work the previous summer, Ryan knew that there were quite a number of dealers who might have sold the weapon to an outfit like the ULA. He began to research them, one by one. The other good news of the spring was that Sally was finally back to normal. As the doctors had promised her parents, her legs were fully healed, and she was running around now as she had before. The semester was drawing to a close at the academy. The final 2 weeks of classes led to final exams and commissioning week. Yet another class of midshipmen graduated to join the fleet and the Corps. The plebes were no longer plebes and were finally able to smile in public once or twice a day. Ryan was incongruously trapped in his real job for a week, finishing up a mountain of paperwork. His work in the Academy's history department had suffered this year, he knew.
Hey, Jack!
Robbie Jackson came into his office wearing his undress whites. Ryan looked up and smiled broadly. He had missed socializing with his friends and colleagues, too.
Grab a seat, Commander. How's the flying business? No complaints. The kid is back in the saddle. You should have been up in the Tomcat with me last week. Oh, man, I'm finally back in the groove. I was hassling with a guy in an A4 playing aggressor, and I ruined his day. It was so fine.
He grinned like a lion surveying a herd of crippled antelope. When do you leave?
I report for duty on 5 August. I guess I'll be heading out of here on the 1st.
Not before we have you and Sissy over for dinner.
Aye, aye, sir. What are you going to be doing?
Ryan didn't understand his friend's question.
What do you mean? Are you going to stay on here or are you moving over to Langley?
Ryan looked out the window. Damned if I know, Rob. We got a baby on the way and a bunch of other things to think about. You haven't found those guys yet?
Jack shook his head.
These guys are pros, Robbie.
Jackson reacted with surprising passion.
Bullshit, man. Professionals don't hurt kids. They're playing a goddamn game, Jack. There's even a song about it. I heard it at Riordan's on St. Patrick's Day. I've learned all my heroes and wanted the same, to try out my hand at the Patriot game. Some crap like that. War isn't a game, it's a profession. These guys go out and shoot little kids. They're fucking street hoods, Jack. Maybe they're clever, but they sure as hell ain't professionals. Professionals got balls. Professionals put it on the line for real.
Jack shook his head. Robbie was wrong, but he knew of no way to persuade his friend otherwise. His code was that of the warrior who had to live by civilized rules. Rule number one was, you don't deliberately harm the helpless. It was bad enough when that happened by accident. To do so on purpose was cowardly, beneath contempt. Those who did so merited only death. They were beyond the pale. James Owens was as furious as anyone had ever seen him. The surveillance of Cooley had been so easy, so routine, but that was no excuse, he had told his men. That harmless little poof, as Ashley had called him, had slipped away from his shadowers as adroitly as anyone trained at Moscow Center itself. The chief of Scotland Yard's anti-terrorist branch now waited on hold to break the news to Dan Murray.
This is Dan Murray.
Owens here. Watkins' suspected contact has flown.
What happened?
An electrical problem of some sort in the bookstore, I gather. A small fire which our Mr. Cooley put out all right. He called in an electrician who inadvertently uncovered one of our microphones. He bolted at once, of course. We're almost certain he tipped Watkins.
We had the same thing happen once, Jimmy. It happens. You've had bad days before, so have I. All the same, send a picture of your man over, will you?
10 hours later, Martin Cantor dropped the photo of Dennis Cooley on Ryan's desk in the windowless, closet-sized room on the third floor of the CIA's main building. London faxed it over a couple of hours ago. Ryan examined it for a moment, then looked at Cantor.
He looks like a real wimp, doesn't he? What's the story?
Cantor explained. Bad luck for the Brits, but maybe good luck for us. Look at the picture again. Tell me something important.
Ryan looked at the picture again. Well, he's lost most of his hair. Maybe we can ID the training camp these guys use if he turns up there. None of the other guys are bald.
There was a strange car in front of the house when Ryan got home that night. On inspection, he saw that it had diplomatic tags. He went inside to find three men talking to his wife. They turned to greet him as he entered.
Hello, Dr. Ryan. I'm Jeffrey Bennett from the British Embassy, and these gentlemen are with our security service, Tom and Nigel.
Ryan put down his suitcase and shook hands. What can I do for you?
Their Royal Highnesses will be visiting the States in a few weeks. I understand that you offered an invitation when you met, and they wish to see if it remains open.
Ryan was dumbstruck. Kathy came to his rescue.
I already said yes, Jack.
Of course. Please tell them we'd be honored to have them.
Their Royal Highnesses would be so pleased. We took the precaution of holding an evening in their itinerary. July 30th. Will that be all right with you?
Ryan bent down and removed a brown datebook from the briefcase by his feet.
Uh-oh. We're having company that night.
Kathy nodded.
You're right. I had forgotten. Robbie and Sissy.
Jack snapped the book closed. The good news is His Highness will like them. He used to fly fighter planes, right? Robbie's a lieutenant commander of the United States Navy. He flies a $40 million fighter plane. He's probably not a security risk, and his wife plays one hell of a piano.
The three men exchanged uneasy glances.
Mr. Bennett, check Rob Jackson out through your attaché and ask His Highness if it's all right. I know him. He won't object.
Of course he won't object, Ryan thought. It's the security pukes who'll throw a fit.
Bennett looked a bit taken aback.
I cannot fault your sense of loyalty, Dr. Ryan. I shall inquire, but I must insist that you do not tell Commander Jackson anything.
Jack nearly laughed.
You have my word.
He couldn't wait to see the look on Robbie's face. This would finally even the score for that kendo match.
Contraction peaks. Panting quickly now.
That's right. They were practicing the breathing exercises in preparation for the delivery.
His wife started panting. Jack knew that this was a serious business. It merely looked ridiculous. Two grown-ups on the floor, Kathy on her back, her tummy looking for all the world like Mount Fuji, while Jack studied his digital watch like the timekeeper at an amateur sporting event. Contraction ends. Deep, cleansing breath. I figure steaks on the grill, baked potatoes, and fresh corn on the cob with a nice salad. Kathy shook her head. It's too plain. He moved from opposite his wife to beside her. I don't think so. Somebody over here ought to give him a decent American meal. I can't wait to see the look on Robbie's face when he gets there for dinner. Kathy would have laughed if she could. It was becoming uncomfortable for her to do so. I'll bet you that Sissy handles it better than he does. How much? 20. Jack looked at his watch. It's a deal. Contraction begins. Deep breath. All the way. Now regular breathing. A minute later, Jack was amazed to see that he was breathing the same way as his wife. That got them both laughing. The next morning, very much as usual, Ryan arrived at his office at the CIA at 8:30. Monty Cantor was waiting for him. It would seem that your hunch was correct, Jack. Ryan opened the door to his cubbyhole office, and the two men stepped inside. Cantor dropped a packet of photographs on the desk. Jack recognized the top one at once. It was a daylight shot of Camp 18. He flipped to the next print. It was a blow-up of the same picture showing three men standing outside of the huts. Two of the men had dark hair. Next to them stood a man with a head that shone from the sunlight reflecting off his sweaty, hairless dome. Dennis Cooley. Cantor nodded. Right. Camp 18's the one, all right. That was yesterday afternoon. Now for the bad news. The CIA man flipped through the pile of photographs. Another satellite passed over the camp at 2200 hours local time. Here we are. It was an infrared image of the same camp. Jack looked at it closely. He had seen other night images of the Camp 18. The difference was striking. He looked at Cantor in wonder. That's right. Not a heater on in the place. Nobody outside. Nothing. Both men sat down. Desperately, Jack flipped through the remaining photographs. They're gone. Nobody's home. Damn! The sense of disappointment was overwhelming. They had identified the actual camp where the ULA trained and planned, and now it was empty. Where had they gone? Based on their past activity pattern at the camp, the terrorist might not return for 3 months. Jack realized they might never return. But if they did, he'd be waiting. Summer arrived with another significant break in the case. Ryan continued his research into arms dealers who might have supplied the ULA. He succeeded in identifying the man who had originally bought the Uzi used in the attack on his wife. It was a South African named Eric Martens who had once worked with the CIA-backed UNITA rebels in Angola. He had turned out to be something of a crook, and the agency had had no further contact with him, whereabouts unknown. And of course he checked the photo recon data on Camp 18 daily. By mid-July, the press began to carry stories about the royal visit. Jack was relieved that no mention was made of the planned dinner at his home. Not long after that, three security men came out to Peregrine Cliff to look around. Chuck Longley of the Secret Service would head up the security team on the evening of the party. He introduced his two British colleagues, Bert Avery and Mike Keaton. 20 agents would be on hand to protect the prince and princess. On the eve of the dinner party, Kathy and Jack watched the day-old television news coverage of the prince's arrival. The Royal Air Force VC-10 had touched down at Andrews Air Force Base and was greeted without incident. Not far away, in a safe house in Howard County, other eyes watched as well.
Where's Joe? Belfast. He'll run phase two.
The timing is all set?
Yes, both brigade commanders and the whole Army Council. We should be able to get them all.
Kevin O'Donnell finally revealed his plan in toto. Penetration agents among the senior PIRA staff were standing by in Ireland to assassinate key members of the Provisional's military leadership. With his hostages, O'Donnell would obtain the release of all the men behind the wire, even if he had to mail the Prince of Wales to Buckingham Palace, 1 cubic centimeter at a time. He was sure of this. O'Donnell would emerge to lead a revolution born in boldness and in blood. Kathy Ryan went to bed early. The baby was almost due now, and she had a hard time staying awake after 9 o'clock. Jack sat up for a while, deep in thought. "They're coming back, aren't they?" he asked the knight. He rose off the leather couch and walked to the windows. He watched the running lights of the ships out on the bay, plying their way to and from the port of Baltimore. He didn't know how he could have been so slow to realize it, perhaps because the activity at Camp 18 almost tracked with the pattern he tried to discern. "And we're bringing known targets into our own home, you asshole!" Jack wondered how public figures did it. They lived with a nightmare all the time. He remembered congratulating the prince for not letting such a threat dominate his life. "Well done, old boy, that'll show them." "It was a very different thing when you were yourself the target," Ryan admitted to the knight. "You could keep your mind off it during the day when you had work to do, but at night, when the mind wanders and dreams begin." The royal party arrived exactly on time. A pair of state police cars remained on the road, and three more, loaded with security people, accompanied the Rolls-Royce up the driveway to the Ryan house. The chauffeur, one of the security force, pulled right to the front and jumped out to open the passenger door. His Highness came out first and helped his wife. The security people were already swarming all over the place. The leader of the British contingent conferred briefly with Avery, and the detail dispersed to their predetermined stations. As Jack came down the steps to greet his guest, he had the feeling that his home had been subjected to an armed invasion. "Welcome to Peregrine Cliff." The prince took his hand. "Hello, Jack. You're looking splendid." He turned to the princess, whom he'd never actually met. "Your Highness, this is a great pleasure. And for us, Sir John." He led them into the house. Kathy was waiting inside with Sally. The hot weather was especially hard on her this close to delivery. The temperature had hit 95 a few hours earlier, and a storm appeared imminent. Greetings were exchanged. Kathy shook hands, but Sally remembered how to curtsy from England and performed a beautiful one, accompanied by a giggle. Then Jack led the party into the living dining room. The prince went straight to the window, and Ryan followed. "What a marvelous view!" Both men turned as they heard a car pull up. They watched Robbie and Sissy get out of the pilot's Corvette. Sissy was dressed in a simple but very nice blue dress, and Robbie had a tie on. Kathy must have warned them, Ryan thought. Further off, he saw the Secret Service's communication van move to block the driveway behind them. Robbie stormed up the steps. Ryan stepped out onto the sun deck. "What gives? Who's here, the president?" Ryan grinned. "Rob, Sissy, come on in and join the party." The pilot's eyes went wide as they stepped in off the deck. The prince stepped forward. "Commander Jackson, I presume?" They shook hands. "How do you do, sir? This is my wife, Cecilia." As usually happened, the people split into male and female groups. "I understand you're a naval aviator, Commander Jackson." Outside, it was growing dark, and the wind had come up. In the yard, the security people cast occasional uneasy glances at the sky. They would remain in position no matter what, of course. Out beyond the drive on Falcon Nest Road, a Secret Service man stood in the middle of the road talking with two men in a Baltimore gas and electric van. The black man at the wheel flashed his company ID.
"Say, what the hell's going on here? We got a transformer to fix."
Avery examined the card.
"Can't say. You have a work order?"
Dobbins gave the man his clipboard.
"Be my guest. If you want to check it out, call that number on top. Ask for Mr. Griffin. Lewis, open up the back, will you?"
Avery sent one of his men to make the call. The van was loaded down with ladders, and the back was filled with a mass of cables and tools and test equipment. It all looked to be in order to Avery. Eventually, the man returned from the communications van with confirmation of the BG&E work order.
"Your left front tire is bald. You better watch it. And there's a storm coming up. I wouldn't want to be up on a pole when it hits."
The driver nodded. By now, his assistant had counted 14 agents, noting the location of each. The Secret Service men waved them on. The problem is, there really isn't a civilized way to eat corn on the cob, not to mention buttering it. Kathy was clearing away a plate of corn cobs. They had all finished except Sally, who was still laboring at her food.
"Jack, Kathy, that was a wonderful dinner," his wife agreed. "And no after-dinner speech-making."
Robbie was wondering what it must be like to be a prince.
"I guess all that formal stuff gets to be tiresome,"
Kathy returned from the kitchen. "Would you all like to retire to the living room? I'd like to clear away these dishes." Sissy Jackson pushed her chair back and rose. I'll do it, Kath. You go sit down. Everyone stood, and Robbie walked off to the bathroom for a head call. Out on the road, the security force saw the approaching lights of the BG&E van, and being trained men, they kept a close eye on it, despite knowing who it was and what it was doing there. 30 yards from them, there was a flash and a bang. Some men reached instinctively for their guns, then saw that the vehicle's left front tire had blown and was fluttering on the road as the driver struggled to keep it under control. It stopped, right in front of the driveway. No one had noticed the ladders before. No one noticed their absence now. The driver got out and looked at the wheel. 200 yards away, Avery saw the truck sitting on the road, and his instincts set off an alarm. He started running. The van's door slid back, revealing 4 men with automatic weapons. The agents a few feet away reacted in a moment, but too late. Barely had the door moved when the first weapons fired, and 5 men were down in the first second. The other gunman had already joined in, and the first group of agents was wiped out without having fired a single return shot. The terrorists leaped out of the side and back doors of the van and engaged the second group. One Secret Service agent got his Uzi up and fired a short burst that killed the first man out of the back of the van, but he in turn was killed only moments later. 2 more of the guards were now dead. The other 4 dropped to the ground and tried to return fire. What the hell is that? Ryan was on his feet and heading for the window. Heads throughout the room turned. Outside, Ryan could see a British security agent raise a radio to speak and then fall backward. A series of lightning flashes illuminated the deck. He saw 2 other agents draw their weapons and dive for the deck. One rose to fire and fell beside his comrade. Jack had barely enough time to be horrified when the window shattered and the last security man was hit. 4 armed figures appeared where the window had been. They were all dressed in black and covered with mud. One pulled off his mask. It was Sean Miller. Avery and Longley were alone, lying in the middle of the yard. The Brit watched as a number of armed men checked the bodies of the fallen agents. Then they formed into 2 groups and headed towards the house.
We're too bloody exposed here. If we're to do any good at all, we must fall back to the trees.
You go first. Avery held his revolver in both hands and sighted on a black-clad figure visible only when the lightning flashed. They were still over 100 yards away, very long range for a handgun. Lightning flashed and he fired, missing and drawing a storm of fire at himself. Longley made it to the trees and looked back. Avery's prone figure didn't move despite the gunman now 50 yards away.
Bloody hell, fall back!
The British security officer shouted a curse and gathered the remaining people. There were 6 of them in all. 5 had automatic pistols, and the 1 Secret Service agent had an Uzi with 2 spare magazines. Even if there weren't people to protect, there wasn't any place to run. Inside the house, Sean directed the tying up of the hostages with a minimum of sound. They have a maid, Alex had told him, black, handsome woman. Miller ordered Sissy to be tied up along with the others. Ryan watched in mute rage. To his right, Kathy held on to their daughter. The Royals said nothing.
Sean, this is Kevin. Do you have them?
Yes, Kevin. The situation is under control.
I need help out here.
We're coming. You 3, get them ready and start down to the boats. If they resist, kill them all. You 2, come with me. Come on. The remaining 3 gunmen had their masks off now. 2 were tall, 1 with blonde hair, the other black. The 3rd man was short and going bald. Ryan knew him. It was Dennis Cooley. Robbie, where the hell are you? Ryan's mind screamed. A shotgun boomed, as if in answer to his unasked question. The shot pattern missed Ryan's head by 3 feet, and before he understood what had passed by him, Blondie's head snapped back, exploding into a cloud of red as his body fell backward to crash against a table leg. Blackie spun around in time to catch the 2nd shot square in the chest, and he was flung against the wall. The Prince sprang at Cooley, knocking him down with a lowered shoulder before himself falling to the floor. Jack leaped over the coffee table and kicked wildly at the short man's head. He connected, but lost his balance and fell backward. The move had given Robbie time to reload.
You hold it right there, sucker, I'll blow your head off.
Robbie stepped into the room. The Prince was back up now. Kathy had the rope shucked off her hands and was already untying Jack. Once free, he stooped and picked up one of the Uzis off the floor and began searching the fallen gunman for a spare magazine.
Robbie, let's get the hell away from here. Second the motion, man, but where to?
Ryan looked at Cooley.
How many men are watching the boats?
Robbie pointed the shotgun at the little man's crotch.
Think fast, boy. I'll make a girl out of you.
One man, that's all.
Kathy had untied the others, and the Prince was now holding the other Uzi. Ryan looked out through the gaping window at the night.
People, I suggest we go steal a boat. The firefight outside may be over at any time.
O'Donnell and his men were too busy dealing with the line of agents firing from the woodline to notice what was happening at the front of the house. In moments, Ryan and the others were standing by the cliff. He pressed the muzzle of the Uzi against Cooley's back.
Okay, Shorty. Show me the way down.
There were two ladders. How Kathy ever made it down with her belly, Ryan never knew, but she did. It was high tide, and the water came within a few feet of the base of the cliff. They could barely make out two boats tied up a short way off. Everyone's heart stopped for a moment. Lightning had shattered a tree on the cliff's edge, not 200 yards behind them. For a brief instant, Ryan saw the boats clearly. There was a man in each. He pushed Cooley forward.
Just one, eh?
The short man began walking reluctantly. Ryan was enraged that Cooley had lied to him.
Keep moving!
The man in the boat closest to them had begun firing, and Cooley broke and ran for it. Ryan took a half step to the right, dropped to one knee, and opened fire. The Prince opened up on the left. Robbie held the others back. In a moment, it was all over. Cooley had been hit just as he reached the nearest boat. Ryan saw his head snap over, and he fell into the boat like a sack of groceries. The gunman in the first boat had fallen over backwards into the water.
Get aboard!
Jackson moved into the driver's seat and found the ignition. Ryan was searching the darkness for the other gunman, but he saw no one. The boat lurched forward, then back, as Robbie struggled with the shift lever. The Prince was covering the direction from which they had come.
Men on the cliff!
They all looked up as Robbie swung the boat around and slammed it into forward again. They heard the sound of bullets hitting the deck and the water around them, and Ryan and the Prince opened fire. They could all see men coming over the edge of the cliff, some making it onto ladders, others falling as they were hit by the fire from below. The three women crouched in the cockpit of the boat with Sally between them. In another moment, they were rollercoastering over 5 and 6 foot waves. The Marine guard on duty by the seawall was soaked when they pulled up at the academy a short time later. He was also very surprised. Jackson commandeered the young man's radio and began barking orders into it at once. First, he contacted the Marine guard headquarters, then he asked to be put through to the Coast Guard. More Marines came running. The women were helped out of the boat, first Sissy, who had taken a round in the foot, then Kathy, then the Princess, who was still holding Sally. A pickup truck came next. It was Marine Captain Peters and Sergeant Major Breckenridge together with a squad of Marines. Gunny took one look at the situation and ordered a group of Marines to accompany the women to the dispensary. Peters walked over to the three men.
What the hell's going on here, Robbie, sir?
Jackson had been talking into the handheld radio nonstop since their arrival. He snapped it off.
Terrorist. They tried to take us at Jack's place. The Coast Guard is tracking them right now. You got a patrol boat ready for sea? Sure, right over here. Zamorowski, make ready the 76 boat, on the double. You want a squad of riflemen, too?
Mary Zamorowski didn't look like a chief bosun's mate, but she jumped on the wheel as though she was.
Starboard back 2/3. Port back 1/3. Left full rudder.
In moments, they were back out on the bay. Robbie was on the radio, and Jack went below to start making some coffee. The Prince stood over the radar screen. There had been no holding him back, and Ryan hadn't seen much point in making a fuss. By now, they were certain the terrorist must be planning a rendezvous at sea. It fit with the method of the Miller rescue operation on Christmas Day, Jack reasoned. It might also help explain how the ULA had managed to land right in his front yard. The Coast Guard transmitted a list of the ships in port at Baltimore to Robbie, and Ryan spotted a likely suspect at once. The Costanza, Cypriot Registry, out of Valletta, Malta. Right across from Benghazi, Libya, Jack thought. Scheduled to sail in 5 hours from berth 6 at Dundalk Marine Terminal.
That's probably our boy. Better call in the cops, Robbie. But tell them to keep out of sight until the rendezvous has taken place.
The arrest went without a hitch. Sergeant William Powers of the Maryland State Police was on board the Costanza when the terrorist tied up alongside. Within moments, he had the 12 terrorists out of the boat and lying face down on the steel deck. Two or three other men, left behind to guard the ship, had slipped away when Powers and his men had arrived at the scene. The Navy patrol boat tied up next, and Ryan, Robbie, the Prince, and Breckenridge went aboard. Captain Peters and the squad of Marines followed.
Be careful. We have at least 2 more bad guys, maybe 4, hiding in the container rows.
Powers had known Larry Fontana, had helped carry his coffin out of the church, and he was damned if he was going to take any chances with the people who'd killed him. Captain Peters stepped up.
Want some help flushing them out?
Powers grinned in the darkness.
Yeah, let's do it.
He assembled all of his men, leaving Breckenridge and 3 Marines to guard the men on the deck. Ryan stayed there, too. He waited for the others to move aft.
Then he started looking at the faces. Miller was looking too, still hoping to find a way out. He turned his head to the left and saw Ryan staring at him. "I am death," Ryan's face told him. "I have come for you." Jack's fingers flexed once around the butt of his pistol. His eyes locked on Miller's face. He gestured with the pistol for Miller to stand, but didn't say a word. "You don't talk to snakes. You kill snakes." "Lieutenant?" Breckenridge was a little too slow to catch on. Jack pushed Miller back against the metal wall of a container, his forearm against the man's neck. "This is the bastard who nearly killed my family." Miller looked into Jack's eyes and saw nothing. For the first time in his life, Sean Miller knew fear. "Lieutenant!" Jack knew he had little time. He brought up the pistol and forced it into Miller's mouth. He tightened his finger on the trigger, a gentle squeeze, so you never know when it will break. But nothing happened, and a massive hand came down on the gun.
"He ain't worth it, Lieutenant. He just ain't worth it."
Breckenridge withdrew his hand, and Ryan saw that the gun's hammer was down. He'd have to cock it before the weapon could fire.
"Think, son."
The spell was broken. Jack swallowed twice and took a breath. He nodded, unable to speak. "I've won," he thought, as his mind regained control of his emotions. "I've defeated him, and I haven't destroyed myself doing it." His hands relaxed around the pistol grip.
"Thanks, Gunny. If you'd really wanted to kill him, you would have remembered to cock it, Lieutenant. I had you figured out a long time ago."
Breckenridge nodded to reinforce his words. Then he scowled at Miller.
"Back on the deck, you."
The hostage rescue team arrived next. They had been dispatched earlier in response to a radio call from outside the Ryan home, but had arrived too late to do anything except call in the paramedics. Since then, they had been following the chase, first to Annapolis and then around Baltimore Harbor in a Chevy Suburban and two state police cars. Three TV news trucks arrived on the scene, adding their lights to those already turning night into day on the dock. The police were keeping them back, but already live broadcasts were being sent worldwide. Dan Murray saw the news flash across the screen in London early that morning, in the apartment where Jeffrey Watkins' body was found. "Bloody fool," Owens had said. There wasn't a scrap of evidence. The letter Watkins had left behind would more than take care of that. The boat arrived in Annapolis 40 minutes later. Ryan was surprised when Chief Zamorowski passed the line of moored boats and headed straight to Hospital Point. She conned the boat expertly along the seawall and they jumped ashore. A Marine sergeant was waiting for Ryan.
"This way, please, Dr. Ryan. You want to hustle, sir."
It took Ryan a few minutes to change into surgical greens. 20 minutes later, Ryan walked out into the waiting room to announce the birth of his son, a handsome young man who would have two very different sets of godparents. Thank you.